Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Hi, this is Brian Elias, president of 1-800-Hansons. Need new windows, siding, roofing, doors, or gutter protection, but not quite ready to buy? Well, click on the banner above and enter my exciting home makeover sweepstakes. You could win the home improvement of your dreams. Come on, get it done.
Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Actually, I'm a little nervous, and I have somebody with me who's a little nervous. I'm not even going to introduce her just for a second, so you can hang on here. I'll do it right away. Joining me is my old partner in crime, Jalene Jordan.
Hello, Peter.
How are you doing?
Wonderful to be back at the Riff.
And Jalene Jordan is going to be on the air tonight?
I am, yeah.
Oh, I am.
I did a little stint, moved to Miami for a few years, but you know how the Motor City is. You just can't stay away.
You can't stay away. Although, what was 2 years, was it, in Miami?
It was a year that I had a studio in my house, and you and I did a nationally syndicated show.
That's right. So, yeah, the two of us were on something called IE America, and this was owned by the United Auto Workers, and we did this show from 2000 to 2003.
Right.
And we were a total flop.
No, we weren't. We can say that the network, I would say, was the total flop.
Well,
and that's why we went away.
There was the other problem was that everything that everyone now says about George W. Bush and the war in Iraq and George Bush's policies, when we said it all then, we lost affiliate after affiliate after affiliate.
Remember, they just kept dumping. I mean, I remember 1 week, I think we lost 7 affiliates. We started with, 35 or something. Yeah. We ended up with maybe 6.
No, 2.
Okay, 2.
The only person that did worse on the network was Mike Malloy, who was left with 1.
One.
And those were those wonderful people. I wish I could remember the call letters. Oh, KTRC in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Oh, yes, a wonderful progressive station like WRAF that allows you, after all these years, to continue saying what you've been saying. But like you said, we were saying it at the beginning of the war. And now, if it were then, we'd be so popular.
We could have been a contender. We're big in Oulu, Finland, by the way.
We are?
Yeah. Hi, Jacob. Actually, we have a listener in Oulu, Finland.
Oh, wonderful.
And I looked at Oulu on the the internet, and it was nice. I'm saying, wow, man, it's all green, and not like you'd think, because this is above the Arctic Circle.
So you're thinking cold ice.
Yeah, but instead it looked like, it is this very beautiful city, there's a university there and everything like that. Turn her mic down? Okay.
Right. I think the quality of life is pretty good over in Finland.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's one of the best.
Yeah, Sweden's number one.
I think, I don't know. Who knows?
But Detroit's like number 5, right?
Yeah. I guess you were over-modulating.
Oh, I was.
That's nothing to do with, ovaries or anything.
Nice way for me to re-enter.
Huh? Yeah, it was my fault. I'm controlling the board here. You'll have that pleasure in a little while. Anyway, Oulu, Finland. So I just went back and looked at it the other day, and every photograph now is snow. So it's so they're all in igloos now, or something like that. Yeah, I got to read this, by the way. I forgot. Sorry. There is an iPod for every part of your life, so you can take that iPod shuffle with you to the gym, dance the night away with an iPod Nano, and watch movies and TV shows on the iPod. Check it all out on Apple.com and keep it locked on the Riff for your chance to win one of 3 iPods and 10 free songs on iTunes.
Sweet. Nice deal.
Whatever the hell that all means. I mean, I don't even have a cell phone.
Listen, Peter.
This means something, though, doesn't it?
Let's get together sometime. I'll show you my iPod.
Okay. Everyone else has one, right?
I think so.
You know what we could do? Who's the other? I don't like the guy very well. We kind of did a Regis and who? Kathy? Is that?
Regis and Kelly now.
Kelly. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm back as usual.
Kathy Lee was prior.
Yeah.
Kathy Lee Gifford. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's Kelly.
So you would always explain popular culture.
Always pop culture. Yeah. Because I'm the one who read People magazine. You don't want anything to do with that noise. You hate that stuff.
That's right. Jalene Jordan is with me. And it's Jalene Jordan, JORDAN.com.
That's right.
Oh,
you're so sweet, Peter.
Well, I could have been sweeter. You won't think I'm so sweet when I say what I was going to do. I was going to bring your brand new CD and play a tune from it.
We have plenty of time in the future. Oh, I have played it.
I thought you meant, yeah, I have played it.
I got a phone call and someone said that they heard you play it and said, nice, yeah, how'd you get that? I said, well, I know him.
You know, there's a rule here. I thought you might say, if I was going to say, don't say anything. If I was going to say my wife and you'd say her name. But she has this ironclad rule about not mentioning her name on the air.
We should give her a fake name. Let's give her a fake name.
Louise.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, Louise and
she looks like a Louise, but that works.
Well, that's actually never mind. But also, we cannot mention our dog's name.
We can't?
No.
Oh, your dog.
Or our dog.
Okay.
Yeah. Or our,
you have some strict rules.
Or even the dog's gender.
No.
I don't know.
She's crazy.
I don't know. I say, okay. Hey. If she's listening, bring the CD, Louise.
Please, Louise.
Yeah.
And your dog, Fido.
Fido.
Or Fida.
Where did that ever come from? What kind of name is Fido?
I think that's a good question.
Greek?
We'll have to Google it.
Yeah.
You Google things.
I do Google. Hey, I am an internet whiz. I have a website.
You're way better at it than even I am.
I do desktop publishing, the Fifth Estate magazine, you know.
I'm very proud of you.
Thank you. I'm very proud of you for this wonderful album.
Well, thank you.
And you've been playing around town with the
Orbisons.
The Orbisons, yeah.
Vinny Dombrowski, a wonderful guy, letting me open up for him all over town. And it's been a good ride.
Yeah. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. We can get email at, you ready for this one? calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Oh, that
remember with them?
Very familiar.
That's what we used on IE America.
Right.
That's when you can't say that word, what's a nicer word? When they fired me.
Yeah, you know,
yeah, I was
you were fired. Yeah. I was in Puerto Rico. Remember, I was off doing the daiquiri thing, and some rum runners came home. All these emails saying, "I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry," and I'm thinking, "What are they sorry for?" So I yell out to my husband. We can't say his name either. Okay, we'll make that rule for him. And I said, "I think I've been fired."
Yeah, our general manager called me, and she thought the other live talent, Mike Malloy, was going to be fired because she didn't like him at all.
Yeah.
So, and she was lobbying to get him fired.
He's not nice like you are.
Right. And he wasn't nice to her either.
Oh, he wasn't.
No. So she called me into her office. You know, I mean, I actually made up this story that I started this rant against religion.
Oh, yes. Against Catholicism.
No, against religion, about being hierarchical and patriarchal. Mm-hmm. And you weren't in the other room writing me, aren't you going a little too far?
I think I probably was.
That's the story I tell. Anyway, so we got off the air, and general manager, maybe you weren't there, because she called me in, and she said, "This was your last day," and projectile bursts into tears.
She wasn't happy about it.
No. And I'm thinking, let me out of here. 2.5 years in that madhouse had been enough, right?
Well, fortunately, there's sanity in this building.
Yes, there is. Okay? This is the best. I've never had anything good to say, and they're not listening, I don't think. I've never had anything good to say about any employers in my entire life. And these people on all the stations in the group here, the general manager, they don't get any nicer.
The best.
They are the best.
Hey, they hired me back. You're rabid.
It's true. It's true.
It is true.
313-298-WRIF. And joining me in the studio is Jolene Jordan, who's going to be on the air tonight at 2 a.m. Now, do you see what I'm wearing, by the way? This little fashionable pullover?
Something from the South Pole.
Something from the South Pole. Dennis, who listens in Antarctica. Now we have Jacob listening in Oulu. I never even finished the Oulu story. Jacob's listening in Oulu. And then at the other end of the world, here is Dennis at one of these geological stations. And so, I don't always, people can write anything. He wrote email. I could write an email. I could write you an email and say I was in, Turkestan or something like that, right? So
Tajikistan.
Yes.
Florets.
Yeah, yes. So it was just a generous gift. So he sent me and Louise, my wife, each of us a pullover. And what does this say? This says
Amundsen Scott,
yeah, South Pole Station.
That is 90, very nice.
90 below.
Oh, my gosh. Well, they're wearing lots of fleece. That looks, that looks soft.
Yeah. So, Dennis, this was wonderful, and we loved it. Let's see.
People sending you things. You're international. Things are moving right along.
Well, yeah. You know that ZZ Top song, I'm Bad, I'm Nationwide?
Right.
Nothing. We're international. We sing the Internationale.
That's
an inside joke that only a few of you are going to get. But anyway, so what Jacob called from Oulu, Finland, calls here because, yeah, things are cheap these days. Probably cost them, you know, like $1.45.
Yeah, $5.
And he was talking. He was talking about the social system, the support systems that most civilized countries, unlike the United States, have to support people. And see, actually, now we're getting a little to the political stuff we're supposed to be talking about.
Healthcare.
Yeah, everything. Everything. It's a wonderful country. It always. I think Finland is the most desirable country in the world to live in. I think so.
Okay.
I think I read last week, but. That was 7 days ago, so I can't remember.
It sounds so nice, doesn't it?
Yeah.
With all that we have to put up with over here.
I don't think I'd really like to go to Oulu right now. Of course, I don't. I like to cross-country ski. Anyway, let me finish this story.
Okay.
I'll never get to it.
ADD Radio.
So Jacob spoke and told us what was happening, and then we got two other emails from other people listening in Finland.
That's amazing.
Slightly disagreeing with them and stuff like that. So
I wonder if is it word of mouth? Has Jacob been speaking of you?
I don't know. But here, I have, as you know, like little or no career aspirations, right? I'm the original layabout.
The world
relax, right? So, and I was drafted into that full time job, and so every once in a while, like right now in Oulu, it's probably. Like, I don't know, 6 a.m. tomorrow or something like that. And so every once in a while, some right-winger will call up and, usually they write me. They always write me. They always write me. And I read it on the air. And they say, Werby, you're a loser. You've got this lame show, you know, late Sunday night. You're
that
nothing.
That name-calling thing.
Yeah.
It's so easy,
isn't say,
it?
Yeah, but I'm morning drive in Oulu.
Sweet. They had no idea.
Yeah, how big I am in Oulu. So some other things drift through my mind. Oh, yeah. Another colleague of ours on IE America was Nancy Skinner.
That's right.
Who
ran
did.
For Senate.
For the Congress, for the House of Representatives.
Right, House of Representatives,
yeah.
Right.
And I thought she had a damn good chance, and actually she did not do as well against this I was going to call Joel Nolenberg a reptile, but, you know, the reptiles
are pretty
decent.
Good.
Yeah, they're decent. Joel Nolenberg isn't. A Bush clone in Oakland County, and Granholm took Oakland County, so I'm not sure what the deal was, except, and this goes to the heart of what is wrong with the electoral system. It's all bought and sold. Nancy raised $315,000. That's a lot of bucks. Joe Nolenberg got $3
million. Oh, surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
And she did surprisingly well on that much money, and I tell you, I just hope she gets in to one of these seats one of these years, because I don't think Nancy Skinner is going to give up.
No, yeah. 46% to 51%. Unfortunate.
Ah.
Tony Trupiano actually was another colleague of ours in IE America.
He filled in for us.
Yeah, I think, didn't he do full-time when we left or somebody
He took
did?
Over. He took over the time slot. There
he did.
For a while,
That's No. That was fine with me. That was fine with me. He got 44% of the vote, and he says, I was outspent, he wrote me, and he says, happy holidays. I was outspent about the same margin, got 44% of the vote against Thaddeus McCotter in the 11th district. Nancy was running in the ninth.
Oh, well, so, you know, it's a pretty good sign, though, that they even got that much, because not a lot of people know who Tony Trupiano is, and not a lot of people know who Nancy Skinner is.
Which, yeah, I mean, and the
you
fact
may have
that...
Seen her on CNN or something like that, you didn't know it.
The fact was that you'd have to have $3 million in order to... you know what they ought to do?
Buy those votes? What?
Yeah, yeah. What they ought to do is that they ought to let the contender... raise as much money as they can. So she raised like $315,000. Then Nolenberg can only spend $315,000.
In a perfect world.
Yeah, in a perfect world. Right, I've got so many. I'm having such a good time talking with you, Jolene Jordan, that got some of this serious stuff here. Yeah, I met a For some, I met a number of ex-priests in Caracas when I was in Venezuela in January for the World Social Forum.
Right, because the Catholic, a lot of Catholic folks are very progressive and very into the anti-war movement, things like that.
And certainly the Mary Knoll fathers were way into supporting the poor, and they were back till one of these popes put the kibosh on it, into what they called liberation theology. In fact, some of them were even... picking up the old AK-47 against some of these torture states.
No kidding.
Yeah, no, they were. So I don't think Louis was. Louis lives in Santa Cruz. He may be listening. Hi, Louis.
Great city.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we were in Santa Cruz together too, weren't we? We cruised in Santa Cruz.
We really did.
You're wondering where was my wife Louise?
She came on some of our trips
did.
With us.
She
yeah.
did. She did.
She likes to stay home with that dog, though.
Yes, Fido. And besides, and this is true, we are the model of decorum.
It is? How so?
You and me, I mean.
With the Regis and Kelly thing?
Yeah, no, I mean, people are wondering, why is he traveling?
Oh, right, with us.
Yeah, but it was...
Woman.
Yeah, it was my... Well, don't you remember we were in the Washington, D.C. airport?
Oh, we ran into one of your friends.
And he said, Peter Werby, and you turned around and he went,
And who is this? this is my producer, I swear. I was just your producer.
Yes, you were. You were. The people doth protest too much. But no, that's all right. I think we should move on.
Okay.
313-298-WRIF. Louis sent a long thing about Thanksgiving, and I'm just going to read a little part of it. He says, Thanksgiving is the feast when we Americans remember the legendary near tragedy of the starving pilgrims whose survival depended upon being fed by Native American Indians. It is a celebration of the first welfare line formed by undocumented immigrants to this continent. The English pilgrims, a synonym for immigrants, were not despised nor denigrated for lack of citizenship, for coming here without the authorization of the native inhabitants. They were not scorned for their poverty, for their unfamiliarity with the languages spoken here, for their different skin color. They were not criminalized for trying to work the land that they obtained as squatters, for their desire to follow their beliefs and values, which had been outlawed in England, for wanting to feed their families in freedom. And then it goes on considerably.
That's powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
We don't hear about that on Thanksgiving weekend, do we?
No.
It's all parades and turkey and...
Are you eating the bird? Do you eat turkey?
No,
me neither.
Nope, yeah. Not eating it.
I went... we went out to a buffet.
How was that?
That was pretty awful. Well, for one thing, it was $23.
You told me you were going, I thought it was.
Yeah, so they had ham, roast beef... chicken, turkey, of course.
Lots of carnage for you.
Yeah, so I didn't eat any of that. So we paid, like, Louise and me, paid, like, with this other couple. She didn't eat even fish. We ate a little fish. But so we paid $23 a piece for, like, bread pudding, you know.
For the sides.
Yeah, for the sides. Oh, well, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was wonderful. It was at home with the dogs, you know, just chill. No family, nothing.
Did the dogs eat turkey?
No. You know, dark meat is not good for dogs. I've heard that. And it's somewhat toxic or can upset their stomachs. Yeah.
Well, our Fido gets...
whatever.
Turkey. No, every day.
He or she wants.
No, turkey every day. And if it's not there by 3:30, it's...
Oh, my.
Comes and finds us.
He or she has you trained well.
And barks. Yeah. Do you want to read that? Are you okay with that? You don't have to. You can...
I'll read it. It's long.
It's all right. All right. This is a piece. This was on the back page of the New York Times Week in Review, which is what it says, a review of the week's news. And very frequently they have, like, photo features on the back page. And I think a back page could cost a minimum of $25,000.
In the New York Times, it's the whole page.
The whole page.
Taken out by Yoko Ono. By
Yoko Ono on the occasion of... what would it be, the 26th anniversary of the death of John Lennon. Yeah, go ahead. It's a very moving statement.
Okay. The headline on it is, Forgive Us. December 8th is near again. Every year on this day, I hear from many people from all over the world who remember my husband, John Lennon, and his message of peace. They write to tell me they are thinking of John on this day and how he was shot and killed at the prime of his life at age 40, when he had so much life ahead of him. Thank you for your undying love for John and also for your concern for me on this tragic anniversary. This year, though, on December 8th, while we remember John, I would also like us to focus on sending the following messages to the millions of people suffering around the world. To the people who have lost loved ones without cause, forgive us for having been unable to stop the tragedy. We pray for the wounds to heal. To the soldiers of all countries and of all centuries who were maimed for life, or who lost their lives, forgive us for our misjudgments and what happened as a result of them. To the civilians who were maimed or killed or who lost their family members, forgive us for having been unable to prevent it. To the people who have been abused and tortured, forgive us for having allowed it to happen. Know that your loss is our loss. Know that the physical and mental abuse you have endured will have a lingering effect on our society and the world. Know that the burden is ours. As the widow of one who was killed by an act of violence, I don't know if I am ready yet to forgive the one who pulled the trigger. I am sure all victims of violent crimes feel as I do, but healing is what urgently is needed now in the world. Let's heal the wounds together. Every year, let's make December 8th the day to ask for forgiveness from those who suffered the insufferable. Let's wish strongly that one day we will be able to say that we healed ourselves, and by healing ourselves, we healed the world. With deepest love, Yoko Ono Lennon.
Wow. That's very powerful.
That was tough to read, even.
Yeah. I could feel... I know this isn't real manly, all you right-wingers, but tears were welling up in my eyes when I was reading that this afternoon.
And she spent her own money to continue to spread the message of peace, as John Lennon would no doubt be doing today.
Did you get to see the movie... what was it called? The U.S. versus John Lennon?
No, it was at the Main Art, and I wanted to go, and by the time I was ready to go, boom, it was gone.
Yeah, well, that was very powerful, too. A lot of it's set in Ann Arbor, of course, with when John...
John Sinclair?
The Free John Sinclair rally in 1971, and when Nixon saw the power that Lennon commanded culturally, and he said he was going to go on this countrywide crusade against Nixon in the war, they said, we got to get this guy.
Mm.
And that's when they started the deportation proceedings, and it really neutralized Lennon, because he wanted to stay here. He wanted to stay here with Yoko, and he spent all of his time, actually, I think, for about the next 3.5 years, or 4 years even, fighting this deportation, and finally won.
Unreal. Well, I tell you, it's the power of the people, right?
The power of the people. I just heard Patti Smith singing. In fact, I was listening to this program where they played the MC5, Kick Out the Jams, and then Patti Smith, of course, who was married to Fred Sonic Smith, in there, in the MC5, singing People Have the Power, which is an incredible song. I was thinking, why do I think these things? It's not going to happen. If I ever had another full-time show, that would be the intro music.
That would be good intro music.
Yeah. Anybody else want to get in on this conversation? 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Well, the healing in Iraq is going to take some doing. And this is incredible. Sunni, Shiite, and Kurdish leaders called Sunday for an end to Iraq's sectarian conflict and vowed to track down those responsible for the war's deadliest attack the other day. And, I mean, it's just not going to happen. I mean, listen to this, Jolene. Past surveys have hinted at this result, but a new poll in Iraq makes it even more stark than ever. The Iraqi people want the U.S. to exit their country, and most Iraqis now approve of attacks on U.S. forces, even though 94% of them express disapproval of al-Qaeda.
Oh, it's such a mess.
And, yeah.
You know, three-plus years ago, we were saying then the Iraqi people did not want us there.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the right-wingers were screaming, oh, the liberation, they want us there. Saddam Hussein, this and that. But they didn't want us there then. And maybe even the ones who thought they wanted us there don't want us there now.
Yeah, actually, that's very true. That's a good observation, because that's what this poll says. This was, at one time, this was primarily a call by the Sunni minority, that is, to get out and to support attacks. But now the Shiites have also come around to this view. This was an editor and publisher, by the way, magazine, trade magazine. The survey by the much-respected World Public Opinion group taken in September found that 74% of Shiites and 91% of Sunnis in Iraq want us to leave within a year. In Baghdad, the Shiites, 80%, and most importantly, I think, by a wide margin, most groups believe U.S. forces are provoking more violence than they're preventing, and that day-to-day security would improve if we left.
You think? I don't know.
I don't even know. But,
those are very telling numbers, Peter.
But, yeah, but it's also, it's their country.
That's right.
And they want us the hell out. I wonder what those of you who at one time supported the war think now. And this sounds like too much, almost like I'm saying, nah, I told you so. And I did tell you so, but this is nothing. When you talk about almost 3,000 American deaths, over 25, depending on how you count, everyone, there's as many as 40,000 U.S. casualties total. It's including, you know, slight wounds, but 20,000 serious casualties as well. 650,000 dead Iraqi civilians, and Bush is looking for a way to retreat. Wait, what are the peace with honor?
Please, this man, don't insult us.
Don't insult honor.
And let's talk, you know, also, Peter, about, what was it, 1 million children who died from the first time we went in to the second time we went in due to sanctions.
Yeah. 1 million civilians, 500,000 kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
I mean, come on.
Didn't mean to
create
you.
Let's,
you know,
throw that in there.
She was,
let's not forget about those people.
You know, you're when I take vacations, maybe I'll go back to Cuba or something like that.
Like,
why don't you go to Cuba if you don't like it here?
But I want to go with you.
Okay, let's go in January. We'll do the show from there.
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, yeah. Friend, there's a conference here. We should go to it. All right. The war in Iraq has now lasted longer than the U.S. involvement in the war that President Bush's father fought in, World War II.
Wow.
Yeah. And remember, think about, you know, the so-called greatest generation, right? And how it marked that generation. And it was less duration than the sinkhole that Bush has thrust the United States into on the basis of lies.
Wow. That puts it really into even more perspective, as if we need any.
Yeah. The Vietnam War lasted 8 years and 5 months. Revolutionary War, and I actually didn't know this, 6 years, 9 months, and the Civil War, 4 years, hey, we're closing in on that. Tom Hayden has written that it is all, you know, the retreat is being sounded now. Of course, I mean, just like in Vietnam, while Kissinger and people like that were making arrangements for the United States to leave, at the same time, Nixon was declaring, you know, he had a secret plan for victory, and GIs were losing their lives, tens of thousands of Vietnamese civilians were losing their lives. They were thinking, how can we get out and not, you know, not screw us up for the 72 elections? Because this is another case. That if people would have known what was going on behind the scenes about Vietnam in 1972, mm-hmm. That war criminal and just outright crook, Richard Nixon, never would have been reelected.
Well, and now even Kissinger is saying this thing is such a mess. Even if we leave, you know, it just, either way, it's kind of screwed.
Hey, if you had money you had to deal with, and you were looking for a financial advisor.
Yeah.
And someone said, I've got this really well-known financial advisor. You know, if I told you that, I said, Julian, I've got this well-known financial advisor. And you'd say, well, how's he done? I said, hey, actually, he always loses money, screws up everything, makes the wrong investments.
Well, if I were Bush, I'd say, let's hire him.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, Kissinger, this guy, he's the architect of Vietnam. He's the architect of the overthrow of the Allende government in Chile in 1973, September 11th, interestingly.
Oh, that is.
Yeah.
He's even saying.
Yeah. So, Bush, I got an idea. We'll get Kissinger in on this. Well, now at least, yeah. So the kid who's screwed up everything in his entire life, if you think about it.
True.
Yeah. Has now called in Daddy's pals to bail him out. And... But I'll tell you, they want to grab victory from the jaws of defeat, which is an interesting tact. Because what are we there for? Wait, I'm going to back up. Not we. What are they there for?
There.
For oil and for military bases. I mean, that's what materially, that's what's there. And in terms of concepts and what's allowable, that they want the right to be able to extend American imperial power anywhere at any time, not constrained by international law or the United Nations or anything. Mm. Well, that's gone. I mean, they've screwed that up. But at least they're hoping they can pull the oil out of there. And maybe that's even doubtful, but at least they want bases.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And they will have them.
Well, they might. They might do that. They one thing, they're going to get rid of this al-Maliki. He's got to go. And, you know, the democratic elected government of Iraq. And also, you know, we haven't heard much from is Iraq veterans. Here, you know, I'm sorry. I remember I used to do this to you, and it was never to make you look uninformed.
Oh, you're going to ask me a question.
Yeah, that okay. You haven't thought of.
I probably haven't.
Well, and the reason that is, and I don't, like I say, I would say that probably, I forgot the question. Oh, yeah.
Oh, come on.
I bet you
give me a chance to fail.
95% of the people haven't thought of this either.
Okay, try
how me. How many U.S. soldiers have served in Iraq?
Oh.
Like Boeing, yeah, you've never, and there.
Okay, boy, I do hate when you do this.
No, well, the reason is...
I mean, a couple hundred, few hundred thousand.
1 million.
Oh, my gosh.
So 1 million. 1 million men, and mostly men, some women, have been
this
through this meat
around?
Crime. Yeah.
Not total.
No. This is from when the lie started in March 2003 up till now.
Unreal.
So, I mean, for one thing, there is this thing I was reading last week that the Iraq war is now going to cost $2.2 trillion.
And what was it? Remember when we started out talking about the war? I can't remember the initial numbers that they spent initially to go over there. Trillions?
No, it was. I mean, they
now.
Well, but see, one of the things that isn't counted in there. Well, remember there was that guy. Who was it? One of these advisors that said, "Oh, this is going to cost $300 or $400 billion." And they said, "You're out of here, man. I didn't want to hear that."
Right.
Because the whole neocon, all those guys that convinced Bush that this could be done easily, and they would throw flowers in the paths of our troops, you know, welcoming liberators and all of that. They said that the Iraqi oil would pay for it all. So the $2.2 trillion, the estimate of these two scholars, including one who's a Nobel Prize winner, I mean, that includes, like, health care for 1 million, you know, the VA benefits.
Oh, my gosh.
And a lot of other sort of intangibles, which reconstruction costs and repairs, replacement parts, training Iraqi forces, or just the tip of an enormous iceberg. All right.
Tough to wrap your head around those numbers.
Yes, it is. And so... When people start thinking, oh, great, the Democrats in, we'll have a health care program, we'll have, no, there's no money for it.
No, we won't.
There's no money.
Matter what, they weren't going to do it anyway.
He spent it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's take a break. Julene Jordan is with me. She's back on WRIF. We've done talk shows together in the past. I guess we're doing one now again.
I guess so.
Hang on. If you want to call, we'll actually take some calls. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743.
This is WRIF.
Detroit Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. And joining me in the studio, Jolene Jordan, my old partner in crime. We used to do a talk show together, nationally syndicated show, and she was also a DJ here on WRIF. And once again, she'll be on at 2 a.m. tonight.
Yes, yeah. Back to the grind.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to find out which...
Jay Hudson, but I have to say, is being nice enough to let me do his air shift.
Wow. That's good.
Helping me out. You know, it was another building when I was here before. They built a whole new building while I was in Miami. And it's amazing.
And we had tape machines. Now it's all screens. All right, Louisa, this is a talk show, so please join us. It's been too much fun and talking with Jolene, but I want to get you guys in on it as well. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And let's take our first caller right now. Here is Tim. Tim's calling from Detroit. Hi, Tim. It's Peter and Jolene.
Hello, Jolene. Welcome back to the Riff.
Hey, thanks, Tim.
Yeah, once a Detroiter, always a Detroiter.
Isn't it true?
Yeah, it really is. I wanted to bring up the number of U.S. troops that have been injured in Iraq.
Sure.
Yeah, I've heard it from at least, I'd say, about three different sources, one of them being BBC, another one being C-SPAN, another being actually Senator Harry Reid. And they quote a figure of 62,500 troops. And the way they figure it is that when that figure is mentioned, they also count the troops that are counted injured when they go to Ramstein over in Germany.
Right.
So the number of troops actually is a very high figure that have been injured.
Well, also, now, let me see. In fact, I haven't even updated my site. 2,876 American soldiers have lost their lives. And, yeah, I've said this a number of times on the air. I treat this frequently like a political figure, that it's another indication of the failure of the Bush policy. But then you think, man, that's right up with September 11th, isn't it?
Yeah, also, you had mentioned the once a site called TBR News years ago.
I'm sorry, what?
It's called TBR News, TBRnews.com. You had actually mentioned it on your show.
Okay, TBR News, yeah.
And they had quoted a figure back as of 2005, it was 6,210 dead.
Wow.
So, I mean, assuming they're still keeping up, it's probably got to be even higher than that now.
Well, here's what I show from the Iraq Coalition Casualties site. Let me see, what is it? I guess it's just called casualties.org. Casualties.org. This shows 46,137. And included in that are diseases, almost 18,000, non-hostile injuries, medical air transport required, 6,500, stuff like that. The wounded are about 21,000.
One more thing. When is the Iraq study, so-called Iraqi study group, coming out with its findings in December?
Coming up. I mean, they better do it quickly, huh?
Yeah, well, a lot of people are really being killed over there. I've lost several friends over there.
Really?
Yeah, because a lot of people, they'd study here at Wayne State, and they would go back. And so for some of us, it's rather personal as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that's one of the things that I try to keep in focus that it is real flesh and blood over this, not a political question. I mean, ultimately, those are the decisions that put people in harm's way there.
But this guy's got to be impeached. I mean, he was a war criminal. Do you know that the CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights, they brought charges against Rumsfeld, against Bibi, against David Addington, Cheney's chief of staff, and the prosecutor in Germany is looking at these war crimes charges.
Sure.
And if he files, I mean, they could theoretically be imprisoned in Germany.
Well, I doubt if that'll happen, and I doubt if that happens. Like, Kissinger has court warrants out for him in a number of countries that he can't go to, much in the way that the ex-fascist dictator that Kissinger put in there, Pinochet, couldn't go to a lot of countries. In fact, wound up in, almost in jail in England. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Here's Al. Al's in Inkster. Al, hi, it's Peter Werby.
Yeah, how are you doing tonight?
With Jolene Jordan, excuse me.
How are you doing tonight, Jillian?
Doing great, Al.
I was wondering if you guys heard about the anti-war protester that killed himself November 3rd in Chicago.
No.
No.
Apparently, some guy that's on the AP, friend of both of ours, Peter Kim, told me about it.
Mm-hmm.
November 3rd, a guy named Mordecai Richer committed suicide by self-immolation in a street corner in downtown Chicago, and he planned it out. suicide note, you know, said that, you know, he was doing it to protest the war and to apologize for all the innocent deaths that our country has caused over the around the world.
Well,
and set himself on fire and killed himself.
You know what? That's an echo of the
Vietnam.
In Vietnam, when these Buddhist monks began immolating themselves, as they called it, setting themselves on fire, and then there was a man that did it on the steps of the Pentagon. His last name was Morrison. I can't think of his first name, and it was so bizarre. I mean, I don't think this is a good idea. He had a little girl. He had a child, a little girl named Emily, and he put her aside. And then he doused himself with gasoline and set himself on fire. And the Vietnamese people, in honor of him, this ultimate sacrifice, as so many monks had, they wore little Emily pins for the longest time. Then, and I think, if I remember my history, this was in 1965, there was a woman named Helga Hertz, or maybe that was her daughter, but... who I knew, but there was this elderly woman who said she had seen two world wars coming and thought in 1965 that there was a third. She was in her 80s, and she was going to go down to the Wayne State University campus, immolate herself. I mean, this just sounds like a totally mad act, of course. I mean, somebody that's like mentally disturbed that would kill themselves in that way and publicly. And I have to say, it's nothing... I mean, it does seem to me to be, particularly within our culture, pretty drastic step.
Drastic, right?
Yeah. Whereas this was not unknown. I mean, in fact, some of the images, you go to books about Vietnam and you see always.
The images.
Yeah. So
right up there with the Vietnamese police chief executing that VC.
Yeah. So either I can't remember her name, but her last I can't remember first name tonight, but. This Hertz elderly woman, somehow or other, she didn't have a car, and she couldn't get down to Wayne State and instead set herself afire, I think, like on Grand River in Detroit. So,
well, this guy timed it on November 30, timed it for the election, but it took the Cook County coroner 5 days to identify and release the details, identify the body and release the details.
Yeah. Well,
which would have made it November 8th, the day after the election.
Well, terrible tragedy and nothing that
and
people
why
should
we
consider.
Hear these stories, you know?
I'm almost glad we didn't.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Al. All right. 313-298-WRIF. Jolene Jordan joining me. Peter Werby here with you. And there's some open lines for you right now. Here is, here is Scott in Atlanta. Scott, hi. You're on the air. Hey, Scott.
Hello.
Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Doing good.
Hey, Peter. I had a couple things regarding one Iraq. Remember how the old days were when you conquered and you seized the country?
Yeah.
I think that maybe that should be a little bit implemented for the Iraq war for some of the money that we've already put into it. I mean, we've already lost a lot of our guys. We paid a lot of money to reconstruct, and the oil's going where? You never know. The oils don't seem to be coming here because the gas prices keep raising.
Well, a lot of the insurgents make millions of dollars a year by the United States imports a lot of oil into Iraq from like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and it's brought in by Halliburton. And sometimes each truck is being paid like $21,000 a month or something like that. That's why Halliburton is getting billions of dollars. But what happens is it's all so corrupt, then the insurgents send the oil back out, and they get the money. So, we're...
Right. Yeah, they're getting the money. And you know what? It's Bush and all the Republicans that are taking advantage of us because...
You got it.
The day after the election, gas prices went up 20 cents a gallon on average across the United States.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even brought up during the election time because, hey, everything was going good. Gas prices were dropping, this and that. But one of the things I said to Al, your intern, was I have a diesel truck.
Okay. Yeah.
And diesel takes less to refine than regular unleaded gasoline. So why is the Bush administration not helping out the regular guys that are using this diesel fuel, like farmers, truck drivers, which is all increasing the inflation rate because they're going to pass the buck down the road.
Wait a minute, Scott. So answer your question, though. Why do you think he's not?
I can answer that one.
Go ahead.
Because all of these folks aren't in the top 2%, the only people that Bush cares about.
That's his base, right. Well,
that's right.
Yeah.
He don't care about the average guy that's, you
not
don't have to make a buck. It's he's worrying about his own buck in his own pocket and his buddy Cheney that can shoot somebody in the head while he's drunk. And then nobody else in this country could get away with that and not have to even confront the law within a certain amount of time so he can become sober. I mean, it's all snowballing into these Republican pockets. But if you look at all the Republicans...
Well, that's where it all goes. People always say we lost this amount of money. Well, that's actually correct. It's a correct pronoun. We, you, Scott, me, Jolene, everyone listening, we've lost all the money. But it, as I always say, it doesn't like disintegrate in the wash. It all winds up in somebody's pocket. So it came out of our pockets, and one of the things could happen, we could get it back in goods and services, in a manner that our communities need, or it could just do what happens, which are what we're both talking about. It goes to Halliburton and Bush's buddies. All right, Scott, thank you very much. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Jolene, do you have a passport?
I do.
Okay.
I just found it the other day.
That's good.
Yes.
Now, as you may know, that all air travelers entering the United States beginning on January 23rd are going to be required to show passports. It used to be that you could go if you flew in from Canada or from Bermuda or from Mexico, you didn't need one. And
right.
In January of 2008, everybody that goes to a foreign country and back is going to have a passport. So it means if you go to Windsor, you're going to need a passport to come back in.
Well, you better get on it then, huh?
All right, here's another question. I always ask Jolene these questions, which she hasn't thought of. And you know what? I didn't think of this either. What percentage of Americans do you think hold passports?
Ooh, that's a very good question. Okay, I'm going to say 40%.
Half that, 20%.
Okay, I should have gone with my gut. Okay,
yeah.
Darn it.
Well,
I really was going to say
all right.
That first.
Think about how many people in this country go regularly to foreign countries, or sometimes at all. I mean, middle class and above, they may travel, for...
We're going abroad.
Going abroad, yes. But the people that really go into other countries, another country a lot, are people that live on the Canadian border, people that live on the Mexican border. But if you live in Kansas or Oklahoma or,
the middle of the middle?
I'll bet you, yeah. I'll bet you 5% of them have, or, 8% of people in Tulsa.
Right. The numbers are probably lower.
Yeah. So it's a lot. But they're going to have to come up with $100 almost.
That's right. And if you need it expedited, then it's double.
Yeah. So it's millions of dollars. And, of course, they're waving the terror flag. That's Terra, T-E-R-R-O-R, Terra.
Terra, okay.
Yeah, because what is it here is, what's his old name? Chertoff, the National Homeland Security Secretary, Michael Chertoff, says where is it here? I usually underline this. I haven't done, didn't do very well.
You know, it's funny, Peter, is with all this Homeland Security and Terra and all that. When was the last time you heard anything about yellow, orange, the colors that were so prominent when this all began and they just shoved those colors down our throats?
They've
make you
given
mad.
Up. Well, this goes along with the last caller. I have three predictions. I have many more. But one is that this is the easiest one. Gas prices will rise. Because these guys want to make their money back, but they gave Bush kind of a free ride, lowered the prices before the election.
Oh yes, they did.
Now this is really the next two are really dicey, and one I hope happens for sure that Cheney will resign
you
before
think so?
2008. He'll say, come on, health, if I have to. spend more time with my family.
Eight heart attacks.
Yeah, yeah. And because he makes Bush look popular. Bush's popularity is about 31%. How would you like to know that 69% of your friends didn't like you? Or 69% of the people that know you, Jolene, didn't like you?
Or even like you more than George W. Bush. I don't know many people.
He's at 21%.
Oh, jeez. I would have to take a serious look at myself.
Yeah. How well, he doesn't.
That?
Yeah, well, we don't base things on polls. You know?
Oh, just so.
And evil. The third one is, and man, I just hope that you call me. You know, I said before the 2008 election, there'd be another terrorist attack in the United States, and I hope someone calls me. I hope with every fiber in my body that you or somebody calls and said, you know, you were dead wrong on that one. You were completely wrong. You were so off the charts with that because. There's a lot of things you don't want to be right about.
Well, with the state of things, you're not off base to say any of those.
Why my voice is beginning to sound like Chaney?
Going into the mafia?
No, I mean the Godfather one. You know what? You know what I found out about? Get this. We'll get the callers on the air. Don't go away, please. Get this. My father, who's going to be 92 in February.
That's right.
Yeah.
Quite the man.
He's a little knee problem, but now he's back up to swimming 14 lengths, back up to the road to 20.
Doubles tennis, 92.
And he said, you know, every winter my throat would get raw. And he said he worried about it. And I said, you know, me too. And it would start to get that kind of, I'd get that thing in my voice and start sounding kind of like the Godfather. I mean, people that really listen to the show a long time know that I play this little shtick once in a while. And he said, he went to the doctor, and the doctor says, that looks a little raw, and took some tests and couldn't do, And my throat was always raw all winter.
It always has been.
Yeah.
I remember.
So, and it's not raw now.
I'm making you nervous.
Guess how you are. you'd never guess this. He figured out that he had this allergic reaction to honey.
Really?
In his tea.
To the bee, can I say the word?
Bee puke? Yeah, I thought you were going to say,
I think I know my limits.
Yeah, all right, good. So the same. So it turned out to be the same thing with me.
Really?
Yeah.
You have, it is kind of weird, honey.
Bee puke?
Yeah, it's a little strange.
Yeah.
There was a time when I wouldn't eat it at all, but no.
Really?
Now, so the throat, it's supposed to be good for your throat.
It is.
Tea, a little honey, a little lemon.
We got to get these spots in right away. Hey, Wendell, John, Bill, Stan, stay there. You guys are next on WRIF Night Call.
Hear the best rock the Motor City has to offer before they hit it big. Motor City Riff. Every Sunday night at 10. It's loud. It's local. And no friggin' satellite can give you the best local band. Like the station that supports local rock. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Yeah.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the second hour of Night Call. We're going to go right up till 1 a.m. and have a couple of interviews. Joining me in the studio, Jolene Jordan. And I want to spell your name again, Jolene, because I want people to go to your website, J-U-L-I-N-E. Jordan, JORDAN.com. And if I would have had my wits about me, I would have brought your brand new CD.
Yes.
You want to sing a cappella?
No.
Okay.
There's a couple of political songs.
There are.
There.
And some real nice ones. Hey, a lot of them about love, and love is political.
Well, you know, and I was going to name it, the CD, Love and Politics. I thought it sounded good, but I named it What She Said, kind of a feminist thing instead. But Vinny from Sponge sings on a song that you have played on this show called Baghdad and Beyond.
Yeah.
And he did a great job on that. And, you know, I knew that Vinny was cool and he was on our side when I was out at the studio one day and I heard Tim Krukowski, who is the bass player for Sponge, and he produced and recorded or produced and engineered my record. He was playing a Sponge song called The Man. And the words were, the man he talks to God, he's going to kill, kill, kill. And I said, that song's about Bush, isn't it? And I said, and Vinny wrote that. Okay, cool. I'm going to ask him to sing on this song.
That's good. Well, this is from Tim. He wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. So I'm listening to my favorite radio program, Tim writes. And who do I hear but my old friend, Jolene Jordan? Welcome back, my friend. And, well, this from Tim from the Bomb Pops. But this is...
That's right, local band.
Yeah.
Hey,
and he
Tim?
Says, we were talking about how dark meat of turkey isn't good for dogs. And he says dark meat isn't good for anyone.
Okay.
I don't know.
Now we know.
Is that true?
I don't know. But, Tim, thank you very much. And I'm surprised I haven't emailed him yet. I thought I let everyone know I blew back into town.
Yeah. Well, by the way, and thanks to Al, our phone screener, who
bought pizza and gave me a piece of it.
Yeah, but he also found out what Fido means. We were talking about my dog Fido, which is actually a pseudonym.
Because no real names can be used
for my,
on this
for my
program.
Household. Yeah, for some weird reason. It's not my rule. But Fido is a Latin word meaning I trust, like fidelity, and that's the whole basis of it. Fido, that makes sense. Why am I talking Greek?
Oh, yeah.
What's the matter with me?
What did they say? Unconditional love from your animals, right?
We do. Oh, I can just see Fido looking at me.
I know. I have three. I can see all of their little
eyes. Oh, I got to send you this photo. Hey, anyways, you want to get out of here, don't you?
Yes.
Because you got to be back here in an hour.
I don't want to, but I'm going to go and, do a little show prep. And
yeah, because Jolene Jordan will be hitting the airwaves. Everything that rocks, 101 WRI.
That's pretty good, Peter.
Yeah, maybe get yourself I could do afternoons shift. Here.
You could. Fill in for Arthur.
Baby. If you're out of town or if you're in Oulu, Finland, you'll have no idea what that means. Anyway.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Thanks for being here. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
I'll talk to you in an hour. All right. At 1 a.m. Eastern time, and if you're elsewhere in the world, you'll have to do the math. We're going to be talking with Jonathan Katz. And, oh, man, I don't have the book in front of me. It's called The Macho Paradise, something about why some men hurt women and what all men can do. To stop it, something like that. It's an extraordinary interview. And then also, we had a guest in the studio, Steve Leto. And Steve has written a book called Death's Door about Michigan's largest mass murder. It took place during a miners' labor struggle in the Upper Peninsula up in Calumet. Both great interviews. And I'm not saying it because I did it, because I didn't do much, right? I just asked a few questions. The interviewees were good. All right, so we got a lot of open lines because we haven't been taking many calls. Jolene's gone, so now it's your turn. 313-298-WRIF and 313-298-9743. And let's see. Oh, yeah. All right, here. Let's go to Stan. Stan is in Garden City. Hi, Stan. It's Peter Werby.
All right, good belated Thanksgiving to you. How was yours?
Mine was fair.
I shouldn't.
No whining here. This is a whining free zone. Okay. Go
ahead. Yeah, I like to start off with where I left off last weekend. I had a nice phone call with you, but the guy who called after me stated that former felonies cannot join the U.S. military or past convicts cannot enlist.
Right.
That's a bunch of hogwash. I wanted to call to set the record straight that just 3 weeks ago I stepped into the U.S. Army to enlist. And there's a procedure and authorities for Title 10, the U.S. Code, and Title 10 is the waiver procedure where it states that each branch of the U.S. military can set their own standards and policy who can be waived. That is, if you got an armed robbery conviction like I had when I was a teenager, they can waive that over time, but you have to meet the moral qualifications.
Okay.
That is, you have to have people vouch for you, a priest, reverend, somebody that was a former military personnel, etc., you know, to vouch for you. Now, the routine use and principal purpose is to determine the applicant's eligibility for enlistment under Title 10 of the U.S. Code. The Army was my best bet, and they were happy to see me. They wiped the cobwebs off the doors and rolled out the carpet. And the recruiter, his name I'm not going to give, but he was a gentleman.
Okay.
And they weren't prejudiced or anything like that. However, they said since my conviction's 14 years old, they were willing to waive it on the merits since I had no gun or knife and I was an accessory and an accomplice, in other words. Well,
hey, Stan, how old are you now, if I may ask?
I'm 30, almost 31.
Okay.
And this is the trick where I was talking last week where they just upped the age to 42. That's
right.
The oldest you can enlist now.
Right.
Well, I was told by the recruiter in times of foreign domestic turmoil, they've lowered the moral standards so much where they're actually letting some people who had cases such as rape and some other cases that were a long time ago, they can actually waive them now.
Huh.
Since they're so desperate for people. They're not telling everybody the truth. Some people say that they're not shorthanded with troops. Believe me, they are.
Well, to meet their recruiting standards. Stan, as I told my next-door neighbor's son, actually, I said to him, when he told me he was joining the Army, I said, you know, there's a war going on. Doesn't that concern you some?
Yeah.
Stan?
Well, it concerns me, and I'm lucky I couldn't enlist because I didn't pass the physical since I got a personal problem with lifting up too much weight over my time and working.
Oh, but, so you're not going into the Army?
No, it's a blessing in disguise. My mom hit me upside the head with the frying pan. What's the matter with you? She said, you make it out from 10 years of incarceration, you come home, and this is how you repay me. So my mama, being the Polish woman she is, she said, no, you better not do that, son. She said, wake up and smell the coffee. You may not come back from this one.
Wow.
But what the military promised me, and this is the catch from the recruiters, the government can close that conviction on you if you serve a lifetime in the military of 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it depends on what branch you get involved. The Army's different than the Navy, Marines different than the Air Force, etc. But they are desperate for people, and your convictions can be waived based on the merits of the crime and what you did, pretty much.
So what are you going to do? I should get some other calls, too. So what does that leave you for options?
Well, it leaves me with options to collect my unemployment checks and pray for a better day. I talked to a lot of my friends and my family. Everybody down the ranks served in the military except me. I was a black sheep of family and messed up when I was a teenage kid, 17. I highly recommend people who do want their felony convictions closed, they can do it, but it's really tricky. The government will promise you the world, but don't jump at it, man, because you may not come back.
Yeah, I think that's it. It's a tough time to want to go in. Stan, thanks for all the information. I appreciate that, and I want to go on to another aspect of this that someone was talking about. Let me get Matt in here because he may want to say something as well. Matt, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, my name is Matt, and that's bullshit. Because what the hell? We're hurting for people to come on, and we got to get in on merit. That's not cool. If the United States government's really hurting for service members, they better start going to prisons and looking for people, because there's a lot of people in prison with a lot of patriotism for this country that won't get to serve based on something they did 14 years later because they don't have someone to go ahead and
vouch for them.
Yeah, vouch for them.
Yeah.
I think that's bullshit, and I just
we're gonna kind of the BS kind of a little rough. All right, Matt, I'm glad to get your opinion. Thank you. 313-298-WRIF. I thought actually Matt was going to talk about something that someone said last week, where they said felons could not vote once they left prison serving their sentence, and that's true in a number of states. But let's see, Dave in Detroit. He wrote in last week to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He said, a Michigan resident confined in jail or a prison that is awaiting arraignment or trial is eligible to register and vote. A Michigan resident who is serving a sentence in jail or prison after conviction cannot register or vote during his or her period of confinement. After a Michigan resident who is serving a sentence or in jail or prison is released, he or she is free to participate in elections without restriction. So the only time you are restricted, according Dave sent along all this Michigan statutes as well, that the only time is when you can't vote is after you have been convicted. All right. Any opinions on that? 313-298-WRIF. Should we be going to the prisons, as Matt said? And maybe we could empty out the jails and the prisons and say, hey, we can get you in. Let's see. Here is Wendell. Wendell's in Oxford. Hey, Wendell. Hi. You're on the air.
Hello. I just had a quick question. I had two of them, actually. One of them is, do you know what the national debt was before Bush took office and how much it has actually increased just by him taking office? And
I don't have the figures in front of me, but there was a surplus of money that the United States Treasury had collected more money from its tax sources, you and I being a big part of it, maybe the majority. I think it's the majority, as opposed to corporate or other kinds of revenue. And Bush, because he started a war and cut taxes for the wealthy, we are now in debt. So I don't have the exact figures, but we're now a debtor nation. So one of the things that our taxes pay for, besides giving extraordinary sums to his buddies that are making the war and what have you, is that we have to pay interest, just like a credit card, interest on the debt that we owe.
The other thing is foreign countries, especially Britain, being one of our number one allies, even like, and helping us out in this war. Do you know how much they're putting towards the war?
Well, I don't know exactly. Those are all good questions. Jolene Jordan earlier was kind of giving me a look as I kept asking her questions. She didn't know the answers to. But no, questions you don't know the answers to are very interesting. And
yeah.
I know the United States, that Bush has given money to a lot of these countries that kind of signed up to send a few men over to Iraq to, what they call the coalition forces, which is, he called it the coalition of the willing, wherever the hell that came from, I don't know. But people have called it the coalition of the billing, that more U.S. tax dollars flowed towards these countries, particularly some of these Eastern Europeans.
The other thing which I found very ironic is during Hurricane Katrina, we gave all this money before that and after, we gave all this money to Iraq for reconstruction. And then when Hurricane Katrina hit, they gave us $1 million in relief. Well, isn't that just like giving us back our money?
Well, that is one way. I mean, 1 million, man. We are usually talking billions. Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call, Wendell. Maybe someone will know the answers to some of the things you raised better than I do. Here's one of the things. You want to talk about where our money is going. U.S. military said it plans to build a $125 million compound at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base, where it hopes to hold war crimes trials for terror suspects by the middle of next year. The compound, designed to accommodate as many as 1,200 people, would include dining areas, workspaces, and sleeping accommodations for administrative personnel, lawyers, journalists, and others involved in trials at the isolated detention center in southeast Cuba. Why the hell are they doing that? I mean, these trials, for one thing, have been, because these men were held for so long, they were tortured by the United States, it's compromised. The whole case against them, against all of these men, have been compromised totally. Maybe that's why they should take them into state court. If somebody was responsible for these deaths on September 11th, they're mass murderers, they should be tried publicly in a civilian court. I mean, they carried out a mass murder. It's not a war crime. There's no war going on. This is just another scam. This is another Bush scam to put him at the center of militarism and chaos, whereas the orderly judicial process could have been easily carried out through what we always do when felons are apprehended. This is a case, of course, ratcheted down a few, several thousand deaths, but still it's mass murder. Timothy McVeigh, who committed a mass murder. He wasn't tried as a war criminal, although he saw himself at war with the United States, you know, these wacky right-wingers. And that's why he attacked the federal building in Oklahoma City. Same thing could have been done with these guys. But this is all political. And it's one thing. It's not like you've got to raise a lot of sympathy for these. Well, you don't even know. We have no idea about the people that are charged with these crimes, whether they actually even did it. I mean, for one thing, like I say, since they're tortured, people pretty often will say most anything to stop the violence against them. So this is just another waste, another total waste of taxpayer money. All right, let's continue onwards. Let's see. Here's John and Warren. John, hey, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing good.
Good. I hear you talking about blaming Bush for everything, which, granted, he's done numerous bad things. But it seems to you seem to come from the persuasion that the Democrats wouldn't do this. I mean, they've been just as bad all along. They're both Republicans or Democrats are both evils.
Well,
it's not that one's worse than the other. They're behind closed doors. They're both the same people.
Well, I think there is, in many ways, truth to that, John. But I think that in the evil derby, I think the Republicans under Bush and what they tried to pull off. I mean, usually they were just into getting the swag, getting the loot from the big corporations and ruling essentially in their interest. Democrats always were a little better because they had to depend on constituencies that demanded social programs and what have you, whereas the Republicans were always just, you know, high finance, big money, the all the utilities and what have you. But the Democrats never tried to turn this into a theocracy. The Democrats never suspended the writ of habeas corpus. The Democrats never set up torture centers and on and on and on like that. The Democrats never rolled back hundreds of executive orders about the environment. But ultimately, I'm no fan of the Democrats either. So I don't want to, even though it sounds like I'm defending them. It's just that
it does, but I mean, like the guy that called in and said that Cheney could get away with shooting somebody who else could. The Kennedy history shows that it doesn't matter who you. If you're a political figure, you can get away with anything you want. It doesn't matter what side of the fence you're on.
What did Kennedy do?
Well, you know, the history of the Kennedys. I mean, Kennedy. There's a long line on him.
Yeah, I mean, if you're rich,
doesn't matter. If you're rich, you're rich.
Yeah, you're rich. You're rich. You're absolutely correct. Yeah. I mean,
that's pretty much what I want to say. It goes either way.
I think it was extraordinarily important to stop the Republicans because they were carrying out an agenda that rolled back so many important little victories that the people had won over the years. And so I think it was extraordinary that they got stopped. This far right wing agenda got stopped, that the war was finally exposed as the lies, the incompetence, that Katrina, all that stuff. We'll see. The Democrats are going to take the Congress. We'll see if they can do anything with it. But ultimately, I certainly have no faith in the Republicans. But, you know, from time to time, within the Democratic Party, there are some decent people. But they're just too willing to compromise. And the whole system is run on money. And when the money starts coming their way, yeah, I know what you mean. All right, John, thank you very much. In fact, our own John Dingell, who represents the Dearborn area and some other areas close by, he's going to be chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and he's promising an array of oversight investigations that could really rip the Republicans a new one, which is excellent. He's going to do investigations into the new Medicare drug benefit. You got to remember, too, is that I used to say that the Democrats, pardon me, we're just the other part of the ruling racket. And To a large extent, they are. But they had to give up some stuff for the people. The Republicans turned this into nothing but a racket for the rich, their government. So this Medicare scam, drug benefits for older people, just turned out to be, you know, who did that benefit? The elderly? No, the drug companies. So he's going to investigate that. John Dingell, Congressman John Dingell, says there are lots and lots and lots of scandals. They're going to be looking at that. Spending on government contractors in Iraq, including Halliburton. Cheney's old company. The Energy Task Force, overseen by Cheney, which was, Dingell says, carefully cooked to provide only participants from the oil companies and the energy industry. A review of the food and drug safety as well. So that's just for starters. So that's good. I'm happy that they're going to do that. We'll see, though. Here's Derek. Derek's in Detroit. Derek, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How you doing tonight, Peter?
Doing good. Thanks for calling in.
I have a question. As you look at the news with, you know, the whole Middle East going to hell because of, you know who in the White House, that liar, I was just wondering, what do you think is going to be like the long-term effect in terms of, you know, the United States reputation? Do you think that, you know, when Bush is out of office, maybe it'll get better? Or do you think that, you know, the damage that he has done is going to be like long-term after he leaves?
Well, I'm not sure when you talk about that. I mean, what this could really cause, rather than the United States trying to meddle in the Middle East like it's done for the last 50 years, let's say, and trying to shape events based around oil and energy needs, that this could really drive the region into an era of peace. But the United States has to come there as a peacemaker, and I mean really, not in the phony ways that it has, not by invasions, not by giving arms to one side and not the other, not by trying to manipulate the different countries to, you know, to war against one another. I mean, there's three civil wars about, you know, going on now. One about to start in Lebanon, the Palestinian-Israeli situation, and what's happening in Iraq. In many ways, the United States bears great responsibility for all of those. So, right now, there is no policy in the Middle East. All Middle East policy is in shambles, in tatters.
And yeah, and I totally agree with that. I mean, it's just going like hell in a handbasket. And you want like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and you just wonder, like, is this going to be, you know, because I think that the damage that he has done, I mean, I think it's going to last long after he's gone. I think that the man has left his mark in a really bad way.
Derek, let me just tell people, if you're ringing right now, I'm not sure what's happening in our phone screeners room, but keep on ringing, and Al will pick it up real quickly. Well, again, I'm not sure what, and I would just put a caveat to you in terms of talking about damage, because that's a word that you hear frequently in the media. You know that Bush has damaged U.S. foreign policy. What he's done is he's destroyed the ability of the United States to intervene in the Middle East in the manner that previous administrations have. To me, that's a good thing. It's not good that almost 3,000 American soldiers have been killed and 20,000 seriously wounded. It's certainly not good that 650,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed during Bush's war. But if this forestalls the ability of future presidents to make other wars, like Bush, you know, these neocons, they were all set to go after Iran, right?
Right.
Now they're not good. They've been driven out of office. They lost. They had an idea. They were going to control oil in the Middle East and provide cheap oil for the United States and the West. But they didn't realize they were pitted against the big oil companies who don't want cheap oil. They like scarce oil. And they lost that round. And they also lost the military battle. Because you got to remember, who's the big oil companies friendly with? They're friendly with Saudi Arabia. They're friendly with Kuwait. They're friendly with the oil-producing nations. They're friendly with OPEC. That's their buddies. So what the hand of these sort of radical right-wingers has been has been stopped. And this is one of the few good things that you can say had come out of it. Like, what good came out of the Iraq or the Vietnam War? The only thing that came out of it that was any good was the so-called Vietnam syndrome, where people did not want to see the United States going on these military adventures abroad. And then Reagan and then Bush said, look, well, we'll invade these little powerless countries like Grenada and Panama. And, yeah, we'll kill a few thousand civilians, but what the hell? What this will give us permission to do again is this, you know, imperial triumphalism that we can, you know, bring the legions to foreign countries and right all wrongs and do it easily, like we did in Gulf War I, right?
Right.
But no more. People, when we, what do they say? I got an idea. Let's send troops to Iran. I don't think that's going to fly at all, do you?
Nope.
No. Well, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. The bad.
Well, hopefully something comes good out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Derek, thank you very much. Always a pleasure talking with you. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And here's Jim. Jim's in Detroit. Go ahead, Jim. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Hey, I love listening to the show when I drive home from work every night.
Great.
Yeah. You had some guys earlier were talking about recruiting.
Right.
And about them saying, you know, they'll expunge records. Being retired out of the U.S. Marines after 21 years and doing 3 years as a recruiter, it's against the law to expunge your record. There's no way they can do that.
Really?
Now, they can make certain exceptions depending on the situation and what had happened. We all know young kids today get involved with different things, get in a little bit of trouble from, you know, being kids.
Right.
And, I mean, you have to go through a battery of interviews with the commanding officer, the recruiters. They have to send it up to the commanding general for approval. We get kids that come in with medical problems. You know, kids get hurt from, like, peewee football, high school sports. I mean, we set up orthopedic doctors. I mean, a battery of tests they got to go through. So, I mean, for them to just wave something and say, no, oh, you join and going to get rid of it, that just don't happen.
Okay. Thanks for that info. But,
did you happen to see tonight on the with Syria and Iran about Syria?
No, what?
That one about Syria would like to sit down and talk about the Golden Heights?
Right.
Yeah. Now I wonder how many Americans are going to be worried about them, too, trying to step in and help out.
Well, I mean, those folks live over there, and as like I said earlier, why in the hell the United States is doing anything over there at all, giving billions of our tax dollars to Israel and Egypt and Jordan and Kuwait is so far beyond me. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it. We'll talk another time, hopefully. Get this. Lawmakers lose patience with Iraq government. I thought this meant the Iraqi lawmakers. Now, congressional leaders displayed eroding patience in the Iraqi government on Sunday, adding pressure on President Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to find a faster path to peace when they meet this week. So the United States goes in there. George Bush sends us to war based on this lies. Hundreds of thousands of people have died, including almost 3,000 Americans. George Bush broke it. If the inspectors would have been allowed to finish the work that they were doing, showing that Bush and Powell, you can't even remember these guys' names, pardon me, were lying, because they were, or at best, wrong, but really they were lying, then there would have been no war, and there wouldn't have been this civil war. And you know what I think would have happened? I think that the fact that Saddam Hussein would have been shown to be so weak that he had to let these foreign inspectors in, that the forces that were beginning to coalesce internally inside of, I guess it's the only place you can be internally, right? Internally in Iraq, could have moved to remove him. I mean, what could have been, you say, well, maybe there would have been a civil war or that. Nothing could be worse than what Bush brought about. And the situation Is it going to get better? I don't know. It worries me. We'll be right back.
Delivered fresh. You want the Riff Rock.
Yummy.
Just for you.
No.
On the Riff.
Yes, yes, get on with it.
101 WRIF has the latest riffs from Godsmack. Rob Zombie, David Gilmour, Pink Floyd, and Kid Rock.
You can do this now. Come on.
When I'm hot off the grill.
Yeah, hell, I'm starving.
Before anyone else in town.
Don't wait until it hurts.
Then keep it on 101 The Riff all year long. With the freshest riffs from fans like Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jets, Linkin Park, Pearl Jam, Tool, and Metallica.
You are worth it.
We bring you the latest riff you want.
You're welcome.
101 WRIF. Everything.
Yeah!
That rocks.
Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Hanging around downtown by myself, and I had so much time to sit down and think about myself, and then there she was. Like double cherry pie, yet there she was. Like disco superfly. I smell sex and can end it here. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting deep clear stares in my direction? Mama, this surely. Yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Dig it. Hanging around downtown by myself, and I've had too much caffeine, and I was thinking about myself, and then there she was. In platform double suede, yeah, there she was. Like disco lemonade. Yeah. I smell sex and can't end it here. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting deep-fear stares in my direction? Mama, this surely. It's a dream.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and we have some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. Remember, at 2 a.m., it will be Jolene Jordan triumphantly returning to the WRIF airwaves. 313-298-9743. Email calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Fred writes in, I'm listening to your show and heard you discuss the great debt that Bushco has raised. I'm of the firm belief that these guys are doing exactly what they want to do, which is to spend so much. The system itself literally breaks down. I believe Ronnie Reagan started this whole process. We talk of the huge debt with astonishment, and I bet those guys toast to it and congratulate themselves for being so on track with their secret agenda. You know, I think part of it was they wanted to shrink social spending so they could roll back taxes for the wealthy and the corporations. But they want the whole system to collapse? I don't think so. It's collapsing. Dollar is shrinking in value against the euro and the yen. I don't know. I get worried. I do indeed. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Gary. Gary's in Armada. Hey, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, Peter.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Good. Hey, I just want to say you were talking about that facility they're building at Guantanamo.
Right, $125 million.
Yeah, $125 million. And what first thing that popped into my mind was, well, if you're building this facility, that tells me that you expect this war to last for a long, long time.
Well,
you know?
Bush has said, remember back in like 2002 and 3, they said this was going to be endless war and what have you. And it's an endless police problem. If you have people that are committing crimes of the nature of that these terrorists have done, those are criminal. These aren't war crimes. They're criminal acts, and they ought to be stopped. And hopefully that since Bush lowered the guard low enough to allow September 11th to happen, that since then that we've law enforcement is on the ball enough to not allow what happened in London and Madrid.
Right.
Indonesia, yeah.
Well, and in this country, I believe, like you said earlier, we try people where the crime occurred, and the crimes occurred in New York City.
Right.
So, yes, if those people are caught, they should be brought to justice in New York City.
Or why, if they're going to play out this fiction, I have a feeling these trials may never even happen. If they're going to play out this fiction of war crimes, that there's facilities within the United States, why in the world would they have to have them at Guantanamo, Cuba, essentially in another country?
Yeah, well, I'm sure because there's things they don't want people to see nor hear. So,
well, there you go.
They keep it far. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for having joined us. Let's see. Here is Larry. Larry's in Detroit. Larry, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How's it going?
Going good.
Long time, first time. Love your show, by the way.
Well, thank you.
What I was going to say, though, was that a couple calls back, I've been listening for a while, one of the guys was talking about how much spending Bushco's done.
Right.
Jackson actually balanced the budget in 1829, since was the last time the budget was actually fully balanced. What's odd now is, you know, Clinton comes in office, he balances the budget for the first time since 1829. Bush fucks it up so bad. I'm sorry, Bush messes up so bad that he actually spends more than every president combined since World War II.
Yeah, that's what is hard to understand. You know, he has all these anti-taxers behind him. And, they used to call the Democrats tax and spend, which, you know, was kind of BS. But, and to some extent, that's what all governments do. They tax and they spend. But Bush would be tax cut and spend. Nothing is crazier than that.
I don't get it. I really don't. It's just he cuts the wealthy's taxes. He cuts education. And then somehow he wants to spend more money,
yeah.
But yet he's cutting taxes for the wealthy. It doesn't make sense. Where's the money coming from? And like that other, like your last caller was saying about Guantanamo Bay and how you were just commenting about why can't we do it here in the United States? It just doesn't make sense to me at all.
You would think that, sure, most corporate boards are interested in what's going to be their return on investment when they have to make the next quarterly report or what's their stock selling for today. So you can think, well, if Bush is dumping all this money on the wealthy and the corporations, that would do some good for him. But, I mean, if they're so rich, why wouldn't they be smart enough to realize that if we're in hock to Asian banks, if the dollar is falling against the yen and the euro, that this is ultimately going to have a bad impact even on the wealthy? It's already had a terrible impact on the middle class and the working class. So I'll tell you, it doesn't make a bit of sense. And I've asked sometimes when I've done shows about this, and you've had these either academics or usually they're academics, economists, talking about the wreckage that Bush has carried out in the economy. I said, well, why do they do this? I mean, don't they figure that this is all going to chicken come home to roost deal? I don't know. We'll see. Hopefully that the Democrats will show a bit of backbone. So, you know, they say, well, we're going to get along with the Republicans. You know, well, the Republicans, of course, are just out-and-out partisan. They don't even know the meaning of the word bipartisan. Bipartisan for them means you agree with us as well. They'll never agree with the Democrats. That's for sure. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Let's see here. Here is Dan. Dan's in Royal Oak. Hi, Dan. You're on the air. It's Peter Werber.
How are you?
Doing good.
I just want to compliment you on your Fifth Amendment right that you exercise every weekend, every Sunday. It's beautiful, and it's part of my life, and I totally, it's so beautiful.
Well, thank you. Hey, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but give some real credit to WRIF. There's not a lot of stations in even the country that would allow me to come on. So WRIF says, yeah. I mean, I don't know if they, you know, it's one of those things, the views expressed. I think they say this at the end of the show at 2 a.m. The views expressed do not necessarily represent the views of the WRIF owners, management, or sponsors. But, right, it's free speech. Go ahead. Sorry, Dan.
Hey, I appreciate it so much. And, you know, I met you about 13 years ago.
Really?
Through the Evergreen Alliance.
Oh, yeah.
And Weave.
I certainly remember. That's going to take too long to tell people about. But this was an environmental. This is another thing. I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, Dan, but you keep reminding me of things. The Evergreen Alliance and women. Tell me, it was a women's environmental group. The W is for women in Weave, obviously. And we were opposing the siting of this mass burn incinerator in downtown Detroit, right around Wayne State University. I guess it's not downtown. Around, right where 94 and 75 are, the I-75 and I-94. And we said it's going to have toxic waste, it's going to put a lot of pollutants into the air, and it's going to be an economic disaster for Detroit. Well, guess what? Every single one of them we were correct about. That's why I tell you, you would do much better listening to the critics, at least listening to the critics. And, you know, sometimes they don't even let the critics talk, and they marginalize us, and they don't give us the full spectrum hearing that the guys in the suits, the powerful guys, the people that are the makers and shakers of history, they think. But you know what? They're a bunch of screw-ups, and they screw up all the time. They're always getting us into wars, depressions, environmental disasters, and the rest of it. And in my lifetime, I got to tell you, and you think about your lifetime, when I know some of you are 13 and 14 years old, and some of you are in your 80s that are listening, but hasn't the critic of a war, the critic of a policy, the critic of economics, the critic of whatever, the critics have been right 99 times out of 100. And you say, well, gee, how come then the critics aren't the government? It's because it's the rich guys that run everything and doesn't matter so much. They've got so much money and so much power that they can keep screwing up. Doesn't matter how many lives they ruin, how many economies they ruin, how many people they kill. Doesn't matter how high the mountain of corpses are that they create. They're back next day doing their little thing. Maybe they lose an election here or there, like Papa Bush lost in what was 1992. But then, yeah, he's back owning some weapons firm, Carlyle Group, that's providing all this weaponry for his son's war, for the next one. I mean, it is a rotten system through and through because it's based on wealth and privilege. I mean, they always talk about a meritocracy, a system based on merit. It's not this isn't a system based on meritocracy, on merit or quality. It's based on whether you have wealth. And if you have wealth, it doesn't matter how badly you screw up. Just think how many times Bush has screwed up in his life, including business. And now all of this monstrous mess that this man has created. Oh, yeah, wait a minute. We got Dan on the phone. Sorry, Dan. Go ahead.
No, sometime soon, this whole society, this whole world, we've got to, the kindness should be the serious thing we all need to live to.
Kindness.
Peacefulness, you know, no aggression, you know.
Well, I'm all for it, but we've got to start working it, and I know you believe that as well. And that means that rather than being a warrior state, the way a war state, a permanent warfare state, that's what our economy is based on, and that's what the national mythology is based on. We've got to start doing it on the basis of peace. Peace! There's so many people that want to cut our throat and, you know, do us in. Well, in the meantime, we have enough power, we have enough military power to make sure that nobody acts out the kind of deal that we've frequently done, this country has frequently done on other countries. But one of the things, if we want peace in the world, we've got to start, that has to be the overall strategy and the overall goal. Right now, it's domination and war, both because the control and exploitation of regions around the world, the ruling class here thinks works for them. And it's this, as I said, the central motor force of the economy. We've got to change all that, or it's curtains for us. Absolutely curtains for us. Dan, peace be to you. All right, or with you, or something like that. Thanks for calling. Here's Mike in Sterling Heights. Mike, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Peter, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to compliment you. I think you really bring some interesting points in your show. I don't always listen because it's life, but I do listen quite a bit, and it is really an interesting show. And like you just said a minute ago, freedom of speech, and I think it's great that you're on that you have this show, and especially in Detroit.
Sure.
I just wanted to say something to war and the war in Iraq. You know, you always hear about the roadside bombs and the killings and this and that, but I have yet to see on the CNN the fact that, you know, only this year it was a little bit over 120 million textbooks that were sent to Iraq for the school year.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, being there is necessarily the perfect thing in the world, but, you know, we're also trying to help that country.
Well, except none of these schools are working, that none of these schools have been rebuilt. This is just another boondoggle, another part of the waste of our taxpayer dollars. I mean, you know, Iraq had one of the best educational systems in the Middle East, and they had one of the most educated populations. And think of it, this country was strangled by this insane, authoritarian dictator that would have his photograph in every single. Of course, we have a lot of presidents have their photographs, don't they, in our classrooms? Anyway, there's nothing good about it. I mean, besides, you can say we sent textbook and we killed 650,000 civilians. It doesn't balance out, does it? All right, let's take, we're going through these calls quickly. Here's Watts from Detroit. Watts, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Quick comment and question. First of all, happy holidays to Riff, you and your wife, Zelda Lou.
Yeah.
And thanks for the info about Yoko and John. Just want to give credit where credit's due. I had contact with them through the years, and they're both really great to me. My question is, the U.S. corporations were always saying that globalization was going to help export the U.S. way of life and to help the world downtrodden. And there was something about China offered to unionize some factories, but the U.S. corporation said no. I didn't get any details on that. Could you explain?
Well, I don't think I can explain much more than that. I don't have the article in front of me, but being I there's unions in China, and somehow or other, one of these sweatshop operations, I don't know who it was connected to, said they wanted to unionize, and the company that's over there doing business on the basis of cheap sweatshop labor said, oh no, yeah. So yeah, we have exported the American way to these other countries, the America of the, like, 1870s.
Right,
when people worked 12 and 14 hours a day in terrible, unsafe, unsanitary conditions. And that's why, you know, we can wear these nice clothing that I'm wearing. I don't think I have a damn thing on, and I that was made in the United States. I can't imagine that I do.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, thanks for the info. Have a great one.
Thanks, Watts. It's nice talking with you. Yeah, a little earlier, I don't know if this is going to be available anywhere else, but it was on the back page of the This Week in Review section of the New York Times, a statement by Yoko Ono about the coming anniversary of John Lennon's death on December 8th. Very moving indeed. Let's see here. Here's Nick in Detroit. Nick, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I read an article about the total amount they're asking for more money for the Iraq war again.
Yeah.
And that it's going to, the whole total for the last 4 years or however long is going to end up being about $1 trillion.
Well, you're lowballing it. We talked about that a little earlier. Actually, the money spent so far is about $500 billion already. And they're asking for something like $150 billion more. But the total cost is estimated at $2.2 trillion. This is, if you think, and say that you and I and the rest of us put up this money, what we could have done in terms of health care, schools, roads, transportation. We could have taken that money, and I'm sure, Nick, you and anybody else could realize that, probably for one quarter of that, like $500 billion, we could probably devise an alternative energy system that would get us off oil completely. Instead, this is, it's not even down the drain. It's like also I was saying earlier, it's not like this, you know, the money disappeared. It all went into other people's pockets. It didn't come back to help this country or the people of this country. It went to help Bush and Bush's buddies. So, yeah.
Yeah, it was shocking that, you know, I don't think a lot of people understand how much money's been sunk in over there.
Now, hey, do you use the Internet?
Yeah.
All right. If you go to my website, my last name is spelled W-E-R-B-E, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com, and on the left it says the cost, the current, I mean, how much money has been spent, not this projected figure of $2.2 trillion, and it's interesting. You can actually work out what Michigan has lost in terms of education funds and the rest of it that we mentioned by fiddling with this website. It's pretty interesting. All right, I got to go, so thank you so much. And I'm sorry, looks like I've left my old pal Maurice on the phone. But Maurice, you got to call earlier. We're back next week. Stay tuned. Got a couple of very interesting interviews for you.
Listing WRIF.com.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. There's a problem that on one level I think everyone's aware of, and that's violence against women. We hear about it all the time. We read about it. And it's sort of taken almost for granted, particularly by men, that it is like bad weather. It happens, and, we just hope it doesn't happen to the women in our lives. Women, of course, are very aware of it, very concerned about it. Joining me to discuss this further is Jackson Katz. He's the author of The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. And Jackson Katz is internationally recognized for his groundbreaking work in gender violence prevention with men and boys. And we'll get into a lot of this, particularly in sports culture and the military. He's the co-founder of the Multiracial Mixed Gender Mentors in Violence Prevention Program at Northeastern University Center for the Study of Sport and Society, and that's used a lot in college athletics, used by both the 2005 Super Bowl champion New England Patriots and the 2004 World Series champion Boston Red Sox. And I'm going to ask him a lot about this, directs the first worldwide gender violence prevention program in the history of the United States Marine Corps. Joining me from Western Massachusetts, Jackson Katz on the Peter Werby Show. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, we're talking about and I didn't even read the entirety of your biography here. You've spoken at 900 colleges, prep schools, and high schools, and a lot of other places as well. So we're not talking about a small problem. We're, as I introduced it, we're talking about a major problem.
Oh, absolutely. It's a pervasive social problem in the United States of long standing. So it's not anything like a new problem, as you suggest, but I have to say I'm part of a growing movement of men in the United States in a multicultural sense and around the world in an international sense who are building on women's leadership in this area and beginning to talk about this subject and bring it into parts of male culture that have historically either been apathetic about these issues or openly resistant to women's efforts to educate and politicize them. But the problems of sexual and domestic violence in this society cut across all the various categories of social class and race and ethnicity and education level, and it's pretty pervasive problem, to say the least. And one of the things that I do in my work with men and in my speeches and my trainings is talk about how personal this is, not just for women, but for men, and how many millions of us men have women and girls close to us who have been victimized and assaulted by other men. So, yes, it's a very big and pervasive problem.
Tell us a little about women's strategies for avoiding violence. I suspect that most men don't even realize that. You and I mean, if we may go down into, I know you're from Boston originally, there may be some neighborhoods in Boston or Detroit that we have a strategy us guys of saying, well, I mean, is this a cool neighborhood? If I got to go here, I'm going to. But usually we walk out the door, we keep our windows open, we drive where we want, we walk where we want. That's not true with women, is it?
No, not at all. And in fact, in my speeches on college campuses to both men and women, I have an exercise that I do that illustrates just how common the experience of preventing violence is in women's lives. I put a whiteboard or a chalkboard, I put a line down the middle, and I put a male symbol on one side and a female symbol on the other. And I ask the men what steps they take every day or on a regular basis to prevent themselves from being sexually assaulted. And I've done the exercise probably 1,300 times, and I've only gotten 3 serious answers from men. Most of the time, men will say, I just don't think about that. Like you just said, most men just don't think about on a daily basis what they have to do to, avoid sexual assault. And then I ask the same question of the women, and I get women start raising their hands very quickly, and they start listing one after other, like, look in the back seat of the car before you get in. Don't use, your own voice on the answering machine. Have a man's voice. Have an unlisted phone number or your first initial in the phone book. Or if you're going to be drinking alcohol, go out with the same group of friends that you come home with, kind of buddy system. Or hold your keys as a potential weapon. Or don't take a first floor apartment. Or don't go running at night. Don't go out at night by yourself. Don't take a job where you have to be walking out late at night, et cetera. I mean, there's just dozens and dozens of things that women do in this society every day.
Now, my niece who lives in New York said that when she gets off the subway at night, she walks in the middle of the street.
Yeah, which has its own dangers, doesn't it?
Sure, sure.
I mean,
these are side streets, yeah, but even, that are dark. And
yeah. I understand that. And by the way, this is true in urban areas, suburban areas, and rural areas, because maybe some of the strategies differ, but the fact is that women don't feel safe in the way that many men do, and especially when night falls, because when it gets dark, women's freedoms in this society are even more limited by the threat of men's violence. And the reason why, Peter, I designed this exercise, and I think it's effective, it was really for men who, many of whom haven't even thought about this, as you suggest, haven't even thought about how pervasive the threat of men's violence is in women's lives if they've not been directly themselves assaulted. And many women have, by the way. I mean, there are 18 million women in the United States who are already rape survivors. 18 million. But sometimes guys will say, well, you know, this really isn't an issue in my family. Meanwhile, it might be. He just doesn't know about it because, you know, a lot of women don't feel safe telling men about their experiences of being sexually assaulted or otherwise abused.
Well, just the fact that they don't feel safe. I mean, we don't want people that we love and we care about and we cherish, our mothers, our sisters, our wives, our companions, to live a life of fear.
That's right. We don't. But I think again, a lot of guys haven't thought about it in these terms, and a lot of women haven't thought about it in these terms. They just have, many women do, an unconscious mental checklist. Okay, I'm a woman. I do these things. That's what you do. They don't think about it in political terms, if you will. They don't think about the sort of larger question of why is this, in a country that considers itself the freest country in the world, why is it that half the population is not free really at all, and what why is that, and what can we do about it? And so when I initially started doing this exercise, it was really as a consciousness raising exercise for men to sit there and listen to all the things that women do. And a lot of men were astounded, and they continue to be astounded, and they think, well, my goodness, I didn't realize this. And then it also, for a lot of women who hadn't thought about it, again, in political terms, they just thought about it in terms of, okay, personal safety, got to do this, got to do that. But I think once you really begin to grasp the how pervasive this problem is in our society, you begin to see why, one of the reasons why a lot of people don't want to engage with it, because it does mean looking critically in the mirror, both individually and as a society, and saying, you know, what have we done here? What kind of a society is this when more than half the population has to live in constant fear?
Jackson Katz, you mentioned a couple of times this country and the U.S. Is this a problem that is just ours here in America, or is it? I know in Latin America, many countries, women are at risk. But is this? Let's just stick to the northern tier countries. What about Western Europe and Canada?
Well, clearly these are big problems in Western Europe and Canada. The men's violence against women is obviously a worldwide phenomenon. There was just a study published recently, and they tend to have these studies every couple of years, big international study. One in three women in the world, and that's a big number, one in three women in the world have been the victim of a sexual or physical assault by a man. Some societies, the rates are higher than others, but no, I don't know of a society where domestic and sexual violence is not a problem. But in our society, in the United States, we have a particularly high rate of domestic and sexual violence. It's not clear whether that's the case because we have a better system of reporting, or we have more services for victims and survivors. We have a more established battered women's movement and rape crisis movement than a lot of other countries, and therefore we're gonna be, you know, because there are services for victims and survivors, we're gonna hear more stories, there are going to be more reports, et cetera. So it's unclear whether it's just because of the presence of those good services that increases the number in our society. But I think everybody who thinks about these issues, both in the United States and in other parts of the world, knows that the United States has a very high rate of rape and sexual assault and domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly inconsistent with many Americans' self-image as a more enlightened society.
Jackson Katz is my guest on The Peter Werbe Show. His book is The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. It's published by Source Books, and you can go to Jackson Katz, K-A-T-Z, JacksonKatz.com, and see more of his work. Also, you can go to my site, PeterWerbe.com, and I'll have a link to his site from mine. Now, as I said earlier, that all of us as men, all of us men, and every man listening, has hopefully at least, has some woman dear to him, and sometimes many And so in that sense, they're all at risk. You would think we'd all have a vested interest in making all women safe. So there is that the macho paradox?
Well, I agree with you. It's part of it. I mean, one of the angles that I use in my work with men is to talk about our responsibility to the women and girls that we love, that we care about. And in particular, the focus of my book, The Macho Paradox, is on sort of a conceptual shift in these issues, because historically the issues of domestic and sexual violence have been seen as women's issues that a handful of good men help out with, okay? And that's what most people think about it, how most men think about it today. It's like, if you're a good guy, you might help out the women, you know, in your life or in the, you know, the larger culture, speaking out about domestic and sexual violence. But I'm saying that this is not a good way to think about the subject. That these are the issues of domestic and sexual violence are men's issues, not women's issues that good guys help out with. They're men's issues, because who's doing the overwhelming amount of the violence? The fact is, it's men. I mean, that's not a debatable point. And it, for example, rape, we talk about rape. Over 99% of rape is perpetrated by men, whether the victims are female, which they are in approximately 90% of rape cases, or male, which they are in approximately 10% of rape cases. The perpetrators of rape are overwhelmingly men and boys, but so many people think rape is a women's issue. And I don't think it's just an academic observation to make the point that, you know, that this is problematic, because there are very real consequences that flow from the premise that rape is a women's issue. Mm-hmm. And one of the consequences is that over the past generation, until very recently, what has passed for prevention of rape is really risk reduction for women and girls. So in other words, so much of the work that's gone on in this field that under the name of prevention has been teaching women and girls how to avoid situations of risk. Don't put your drink down, you know, because of rape drugs, or don't go up to a man's hotel room that you don't know late at night, or note the warning signs in abusive relationships, so that if you're in a heterosexual relationship with a man or a young man, and he's making every decision about the kind of clothes you can wear or the kind of movies you can see, the kind of friends you can have, this is, you know, bad because he's already controlling you, but that controlling behavior could be leading to physical violence, because that is a typical pattern. The point is, the focus is almost always on girls and women and how they can know about and avoid risk. And I'm saying that that's not really prevention, because if women take all the steps that they need to take, including some of the things that I was talking about earlier on a daily basis, even if they do take all those precautions, they might be victimized anyways. But if they don't get it, then the next woman or girl next to them is going to get it, because if a man is a perpetrator, if a man has issues, if a man wants to or is seeking women to dominate or victimize, they're going to find another victim, all right? So the point is, the true prevention means working with men and working with boys and working with institutions in our society that are largely controlled by men, especially white men. That's who has the most power and social power in this society. And that's a shift in men's thinking. So and women's thinking, one of the ways that I, again, approach the work with men is to talk about our responsibility to the women around us. But I say our responsibility to the women around us is not just to, quote unquote, keep them safe by teaching them to avoid risk, but it's rather to be, as men, to start challenging each other, to start speaking out when you see men around you being sexist or acting out in abusive ways towards women. The goal, Peter, is to get men to start engaging with each other and working with women on these issues, not against them. I reject out of hand the idea that somehow this is a men against women problem. I don't believe that for a second. And as you've said and as I've said, so many of us men have women and girls close to us who we care desperately about. And I think it's our responsibility, therefore, as men, to start taking some risks, and especially risks involving challenging other men's abusive behavior. Because the focus of my work, whether it's in the sports culture, in the military, in high schools, on college campuses, the focus of my work with men and boys is not with men and boys as perpetrators or potential perpetrators, but as what we call bystanders, friends, teammates, classmates, coworkers, squad members in the military, guys who are not themselves abusive. We challenge those guys to speak up and challenge other men who might be abusive or going down that path. So that's a very different approach than sure. most people expect.
Well, Jackson Katz, I actually want to talk about these institutions because you've worked with so many of them, including the military, including sports teams. But I just like a more, I don't know, general or theoretical question. The official messages of this society certainly say rape is illegitimate, violence against women is illegitimate, spousal abuse is illegitimate, child abuse is illegitimate, yet it's at this level where we're talking about millions. So where does the social permission come from that allows so many men to act out negatively against the official messages?
That's a very good question. Well, I'll give you one example. The media culture and the entertainment media is just filled with images of men assaulting women and the sort of glamorization of that abusive behavior. And it's not condemned. It's actually celebrated. Look at, to use a local reference, look at the rapper Eminem. Look at his career.
From Detroit, yeah.
He's absolutely taken homicidal misogyny or the hatred of women or the violent, aggressive lyrics about women to a new low, I think, in popular music culture, and he's celebrated. He's a multi-platinum artist. He won an Oscar. So when we say it officially as a society, we say rape is bad and domestic violence is unacceptable. Talk about a mixed message. We're honoring an artist who is absolutely, exhibit A of endorsing that level of violence. And I'm not uncomplicated in my understanding of art and lyrics and the complexities of artistic statements, but I think anybody who is, a thinking person can't listen to some rap lyrics and rock lyrics, some of them, and say that this is not endorsing sexism, that it's not somehow legitimizing abusive behavior.
Well, certainly, even in any of that, and then, of course, Eminem's reaction to that is he's singing in character, but for whatever, there's some people that are singing very directly with those, about very negative imagery of women and their suppression by men. And you're not the only person to read that into Eminem's lyrics either, to be sure. But, of course, anybody can sing anything. But the fact that it has an attraction for millions of others, and I suspect primarily men, is more what? You know what I'm saying? If I started singing about space aliens, probably no one would buy the CD. If all of a sudden millions of people were interested in me singing about space aliens, you'd think, wow, what social significance does it have that so many people are interested in that?
That's right.
So it's the audience
that's right.
Yeah, there's one Eminem, there's millions of guys that buy his CD.
That's right. And I think that's an important thing to look at. And what's going on in so many men's lives that they would endorse by their consumer dollars, by purchasing Eminem CDs, by listening along, by singing along, by knowing every word to the lyrics in some cases. What is going on there? And when I know Eminem's music really well. I know the lyrics really well. And by the way, obviously Eminem is a local product, if you will, in the Detroit area. But he's obviously only one of many, many artists who have, male artists, who over the past generation have made enormous profits by basically verbally assaulting women in his lyrics. One question I would ask people who would say, oh, well, there's no difference between, there's no connection between the media culture that glamorizes and talks about sexism and or sexually degrading lyrics about women. There's no connection between that and real rape, which I think, by the way, is absurd to say, but people do say it. On college campuses, something like 1 in 4 women will be the victim of a rape or attempted rape in her lifetime in the United States right now in 2006. Okay, 1 in 4 women will be the victim of a rape or an attempted rape during her college years. This is a pervasive problem. And so related to the premise of your question, we have to ask ourselves, why? Why do so many men act out in these ways? And, most men who are perpetrators, most men who are abusive towards women are not sick men. They're not sociopaths. They're not deeply disturbed individuals. In fact, they're disturbingly normal in many cases. And most men who rape women, for example, are not psychologically different than the average guy. Some are. There are sociopathic rapists. There are sadists who rape. But most men who rape are not sick, and they're not mentally disturbed. They're more normal, average guys. And then the question becomes, how is our culture producing so many men who have this anger towards women, or who have this hostility towards women, or who have what they feel as the license to act out in abusive ways towards women? And that's one of the ways by framing it like that, how is our society producing these men, we can take a step back and look at all the different aspects of the society. Entertainment culture is one piece. And say that in some ways we have normalized abusive behavior towards women. It's not so aberrational or so different. It's much more common than that. And even though I do agree with you that on an official level there is a condemnation of abusive behavior, the message we're sending to young men and boys in the society is very mixed by any number of measures.
I was going to say, I've got about 10 more questions, which probably would take you 5 minutes apiece to answer, and we've got about 4.5 minutes, and that's my fault. I mean, this is an extraordinary important topic. The book is The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. Jackson Katz, the author, is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. Let's just do maybe two questions and split them into maybe two-minute answers, although it doesn't do them justice. You've been a consultant to sports teams and the military. How did that come about, and what are the concerns of those institutions?
Well, in the early 90s, I started a program called the MVP program, Mentors in Violence Prevention, at the Center for the Study of Sport and Society at Northeastern University in Boston, which is an institute that deals with social issues using sports as a way to talk about racism and sexism and all kinds of other issues. And my thinking in starting the MVP program wasn't about going into the sports culture and dealing with the problems of male athletes assaulting women. It was about the leadership platform that men who have already some status in male culture, the leadership platform that they have, and I knew that male athletes have a stature in significant parts of male culture, and I thought if we can get guys who already have status to start standing up and speaking out about rape and domestic violence and sexual harassment, then it would make it easier for other men to do it. And I think that one of the reasons why so few men have been leaders on these issues is because it takes courage and strength and self-confidence for a man or a young man to stand up and challenge his peers about the way that they think about and talk about and treat women and girls. It's really a leadership issue. And so my work in the sports culture began with that premise, and then the MVP program has expanded. It's become the leading gender violence prevention program in college and professional athletics. We work with now about one quarter of the National Football League teams. And the approach that we use when we work with, say, professional or collegiate athletes is the same as we would with any other group of men, to be quite honest with you. We challenge them in a positive way. We don't go into a room full of, say, of college football players and point our finger at them and say, you know, you guys better stop doing bad things to women, or we know that some of you will if you don't listen to people like us. We don't go in with our finger pointed. We go in with a positive challenge, and we say, guys, come on, the women and girls that we live with have to live with an incredible level of violence or the threat of it from other men, from the trauma effects of abuse in their earlier relationships or when they were children. This is an incredibly common problem in women's and girls' lives, and we as men are in a position to do something about it. Are you guys some of the guys in your generation that have the strength, the courage, the conviction to actually begin to change this? And by challenging them to rise to what Abraham Lincoln referred to as the better angels of their nature, a lot of men respond positively.
1 minute with the military. 60 seconds only, I'm sorry to say.
Sure. The military came to us. Somebody in the Marine Corps knew about our work with athletes, thought it would translate into the Marine Corps. We did a bunch of sort of pilot programs early on in the mid-90s in the Marine Corps, and it took the whole approach that we used, positive challenge, standing up for what is right, challenging Marines to stand up for what is right, to challenge each other's sexist attitudes and behaviors. It translated, and we've been in the Marine Corps for almost 9 years, all over the world, training Marines in the same exact concepts that we train high school students and college students and professional and collegiate athletes.
I think you may have already mentioned, I mean, you have a list here, 10 things men can do to prevent gender violence, which we're not going to be able to get to because we have about actually 60 seconds left. You go to Jackson Katz, KATZ.com, or my website, PeterWerbe.com, and see this list. If you had to leave people with one, what would you say?
Don't be silent. If you're a guy and you're not abusive to women and girls, but you see it around you, you see guys acting out in abusive ways, you see your buddy, your friend, your drinking buddy, or, you know, a guy you play poker with, a guy in your workplace talking trash about women or mistreating his girlfriend, don't be silent. Speak up. The basic concept here is that if you yourself are not violent, but you don't challenge men around you who are, then in a sense your silence is a form of consent to their violence. And I think most men don't want to be consenting to and part of the problem of men's violence against women. They just haven't figured out what they can do about it. And I'm suggesting that the one thing, the most important thing they can do about it is to make it their issue. And I always say to men, Peter, that the most important person whose opinion of you counts is yourself.
Sure.
So I say to guys, do whatever you have to do so you can look yourself in the mirror and say that you're, as a man, making the world a better and a safer place for the women and girls that you care about. Because if you can look yourself in the mirror, whether your friends support you when you challenge them or they get angry at you for challenging them, it doesn't really matter because you know that you can hold your head high.
And there's more at JacksonKatz.com. And actually, I'm going to just leave people with one that I saw one time for a feminist group said, never touch another person without permission. They said that would go a long way to solving most of the problems in the world. Thank you so much for being with me. The Macho Paradox is the book, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. That means me. That means you. Jackson Katz, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much for having me on, Peter.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIM.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you, and a pleasure to have in the studio with me a guest who's written a book about Michigan's largest mass murder. That's right. And it's something not just a crime. It has all sorts of social and political implications to it. The book is called Death's Door, The Truth Behind Michigan's Largest Mass Murder. And joining me in the studio is Steve Leto. Steve Leto has degrees in law and history. He's an adjunct professor at the University of Detroit Mercy. This is his third book. He wrote a biography of NASCAR great Bobby Isaac, one on the Chrysler Turbine car, and now turning to The Truth Behind Michigan's Largest Mass Murder. And what we're talking about is Christmas Eve 1913. More than six dozen people were crushed to death as they tried to get out of the second floor of the Italian Hall in Calumet, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula. Someone had cried fire at the top of the stairs. Now, I have praise for the book, as it says on the back, and I read the manuscript, and here's what I say. Leto puts events back together with the eye of a crime scene investigator and a first-class historian. It's a pleasure to welcome to the Peter Werby Show, Steve Leto. Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
This is an incredible book, and it's certainly what one of the attractions to it, for me, is it's what I call these hidden histories.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, this doesn't seem exactly, I mean, of course, your previous books don't have exactly a pattern to it. How did you come to this? And we'll tell people in just a minute what we're talking about, but first, maybe in doing that, you could tell us your interest and the basic outlines of the story.
My family's from the Upper Peninsula. I've got five brothers who were born in Hancock, and my grandfather was a dean at Suomi College, which is the Finnish university up there. And so I've always spent my summers up there, and growing up, I'd always heard the story of the Italian Hall tragedy. And it's one of those events that people would speak about in hushed tones, and occasionally when my grandparents were speaking about it, they would change from English into Finnish because they didn't want to speak about it out loud where children might hear about it. And so as an adult, I started thinking about it, going, I wonder if anybody's ever written a full-length book about this topic. And I went and looked into it, and it turns out nobody ever had. So I decided that I would research it now that I've got my degree in law and a degree in history and try to figure out what we know today and sift through all the legends and find out what really is there.
Now, on the face of it, this just seems like a terrible tragedy. There's a Christmas Eve party going on for minors, and someone calls fire. It's the old yelling fire in a crowded theater,
mm-hmm.
exactly what everyone fears. And six dozen people are trampled and crushed to death.
Yeah.
Whoa, more than just a tragedy, what are the other aspects of it that that make it this mystery?
Well, the context it occurred in, it was in the middle of a miners' strike. They call the Keweenaw Peninsula the copper country. And there are copper mines up there. And at the time, Calumet was a huge town. There was a population of close to 80,000 people in the community. And almost everyone derived their income from the copper mines. And the copper mines themselves had been shut down that summer due to a strike. The Western Federation of Miners had come to town and actually managed to organize all the Finns, the Italians, the Croatians, and gotten them to basically walk out on the job. So the mines were shut down. The mines refused to negotiate with the striking miners. And so both sides were digging their heels in. And that was the context that on Christmas Eve, there was a party being thrown for the children of the striking miners. And it's my theory that what happened was one of the strike breakers, people who were brought in from the outside to disturb the strikers, somebody had ran in and yelled fire specifically to break the party up.
What, not having any necessarily the intention of creating a mass murder?
No. The person who yelled fire probably didn't think, hey, I'm going to kill somebody by doing this. But he probably should have, upon better reflection, thought, hey, if I do this, it possibly could hurt somebody. And the fact that 73 people died certainly was a direct result of him yelling fire. There's absolutely no evidence that there was a fire. I mean, it's pretty much carved in stone that the person who yelled fire did not do it because they thought there was a fire. They did it for some other purpose.
Now, when we're looking back on history, Steve Leto, I know it's difficult always to find exact evidence, and I've heard the word now from you several times, probably. How does one deal with that? I mean, it's got to be, to some extent, suppositions.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? As a historian, historians go back and try to find primary sources. That is the evidence or the documents or the materials that are closest to the source. Obviously, as time goes by and memories fade and evidence gets changed or reproduced, you start losing details. So I went back and found transcripts from the original hearings. I got all the original newspaper reports, which, by the way, are not worthwhile as a historical source. They were so slanted at the time, it was bizarre.
Against the miners, I
suspect. Yes, absolutely. In fact, the mine owners actually had bought interests in many of the local newspapers. And the local newspapers were really nothing but just a mouthpiece for the mines to get their propaganda out. And so I went back and got the transcripts, the original documents. I've got, you know, I read all the correspondence between the president of the mine and the board of directors back in Boston, you know, and I got to as many of the original sources as I could and sifted through that to try to find out what would stand up to historical scrutiny.
Now, the Western Federation of Miners, that was considered to be a fairly radical union as opposed to the American Federation of Labor.
Well, and it depends on who you're talking to. Obviously, if you asked the mine management what they thought of the unions, they said, yeah, they were all, you know, radical socialists, and they thought, you know, it's kind of like calling somebody a commie in the 60s. But in reality, they weren't agitating and saying, hey, let's blow things up, let's kill people. They were basically saying, hey, let's hold out, let's refuse to work until we get more money. And the average miner at the time was making $2.50 a day for extremely grueling, back-breaking labor for 10 hours a day. And at that time, if you lost a limb in the mines or if you got killed, your widow would get, you know, a handshake and a card, and by the way, get out of your house within 15 days because the mine owns the house.
What effect did this tragedy have on the strike? Did it galvanize people and get them on to win, or did they lose the strike?
They lost the strike, and I think it's mainly because it scared the heck out of them. I think that the miners saw what happened. They saw the 73 children, well, 60 of them were children, but they saw the 73 dead people laid out on Christmas Eve and thought, wow, you know, these people will really go to all extents to break this strike. And in April of 1914, the strike broke because the miners voted to go back to work.
So these mostly were children. Well, on Christmas Eve, I can't imagine a more horrible situation. Were you able to find out, other than the devastating aspect of such a tragedy would have on people, on the parents, on the community, what effect this had on the entire town? It must have been terrible.
People still talk about this up there, and you can go find old-timers, and if you mention the Italian Hall, you don't have to say what the date was, the year, anything, and you can tell that it's something that still is an extremely deep-running scar, for lack of a better word. And I've been at book signings now in Calumet just a few weeks ago, and I had old people coming up to me and saying, you know, hey, I had an aunt there, I had an uncle there, I had a friend there, cousin, and in a community even that large of 80,000 people, when you have 73 people get killed, everybody knows somebody.
The book is Death's Door, The Truth Behind Michigan's Largest Mass Murder. It's published by Momentum. And actually, you can go to italianhall.blog.com. And also, I'll have a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Now, Steve Leto, you've been up there. This is where essentially the book was released, up in the Upper Peninsula. And were you surprised at the, I mean, I remember we've had some email contact, and you were just saying this was like standing room only and huge book signings. Did you expect that?
You know, I was optimistically hoping that would happen, but I was surprised, and even the people hosting me up there were surprised. I spoke at Finlandia University, which is what they've renamed Suomi College now. My grandfather's probably spinning in his grave as a result, but the initials are FU, and so they sell a lot more bumper stickers now. But I spoke at Finlandia, and they had to have me speak three times because the hall was booked to capacity, the first two speakings. And at one of those engagements, it was standing room only. And we had close to 500 people show up. And I you know, I jokingly said to somebody, I didn't know that you guys had 500 people up here. But it seems like everybody came out because it's such an emotional topic still to this day.
Well, I assume you said there was elderly people there, but if it was at a college, there must have been young people as well. And was the interest historical and the nostalgic? Because, hey, it happened in our town where it looks like nothing else ever happens. Was there an understanding of the labor and political issues involved?
Somewhat. And I think a lot of the people really appear to be grateful that I told the story sympathetically to the workers. There have been a few other books that have addressed this topic, but for whatever reason, they've almost been sympathetic to the mines. And there's a famous book written by a guy named Arthur Turner called Rebels on the Range. And he basically takes a position that the strikers were misled by these outside agitators. And so if anything bad happened to them, it was because they were basically duped into going along with this wacky scheme of going on strike. And that's not what happened at all, really. The Western Federation of Miners, when they held the vote to go on strike, it was almost unanimous for the strikers to go out. So, you know, they weren't misled. They were, you know, it was ripe for that time.
Well, and if I remember correctly, the Western Federation of Miners probably at that time was led by Big Bill Haywood.
Yes.
I don't think we would have considered him radical in the 1930s. We would have considered him like a Walter Reuther or Jimmy Hoffa at his best and what have you. But at that time, of course, that Samuel Gompers led the American Federation of Labor, and he was only organizing craft workers, thought the best way to get along with management was to get along with them and go along with them, whereas groups like the Industrial Workers of the World and the Western Mining Federation, Western Federation of Miners, they were more into direct action among the lowest workers in this country.
In fact, the newspaper that I got a lot of information from is called Tuomis, which is a Finnish word that translates into roughly worker. But it has a connotation of being the lowest level of worker. And that newspaper was actually probably the largest circulation newspaper in the QAnon at the time, entirely in Finnish, because there are that many Finnish people up there. And so that's one of the other things about the story is it's very ethnic, and it's almost, I like to use the word racial, because nowadays we tend to think of race as being only black and white, when in reality back then race was English-speaking versus non-English-speaking. And you had this bright divide in 1913 in Calumet where half the world spoke English, and it was all mine management and business. And the people who didn't speak English were the hard workers down underground in the mines who spoke Finnish, Croatian, Italian, and things like that.
Well, I've heard, actually, that they tell Finn jokes
in
the UP instead of they take the Polish jokes that actually aren't very appropriate. But
right.
They just said, how many Finns does it take to...
Exactly.
Whereas, I don't know, I mean, Finns, they talk about an industrious and enlightened people. I actually have a listener that's in Oulu, Finland, where the University of Oulu is, who keeps inviting me over there. He he listens on the internet to this station. In the studio with me, Steve Leto. The book is Death's Door, The Truth Behind Michigan's Largest Mass Murder, and it's published by Momentum Publications. And you said it's a division of Our Magazine, H-O-U-R?
Yeah, Our Detroit Media is the parent corporation, and that's one of the reasons the book looks so nice.
It is sharp-looking.
I can tell you, I wrote the words that are between the covers, and I turned the manuscript into them, and they turned it into a work of art. And you'll notice that we have a great photo section in the middle.
You do indeed.
It's the most comprehensive photo collection on the Italian Hall. I've got a picture of the previous hall, the one that burned down in 1907, as well as the hall itself. I've got photographs of the interior. The hall got knocked down in 1984. So if you go to where the hall was now, there's just a vacant lot, and they saved the arch, and there's a historical marker there. But I've got photographs from inside the hall right before they knocked it down. And so I tried to make it, you know, I know there's people out there who like to see pictures.
Sure.
The pictures are there as well.
Well, if you would have come to me, which fortunately you didn't, and said, where do you think I could get this published? I would have said, well, try Wayne State University. How did you hook up with Our? I mean, they're so, you know, au courant and very...
It's interesting, but there was a publisher, one of the editors there. I'd sent emails simultaneously to three places. And all three of them expressed interest, and one of them was Wayne State University. And the other one was my editor at Momentum Books. His name is Ed Peabody. And he emailed me back immediately and said, I'm familiar with the story. I think it's a great idea. Send me the manuscript. And I liked the idea that a guy from down here had heard the story before and was familiar with it, even though he wasn't a history guy the way that like the Wayne State people are. And nothing against Wayne State, but most university presses are extremely slow to deal with.
If my brain clicks into gear, I'll remember the man who's done so much of the history, Michigan history series from up there. I don't know if you, I guess not who you spoke with either, but he one time gave me a little piece of copper and also a book that he'd written about the mines up there.
Okay.
And I would have thought on the face of it that would be a natural, but here, of course, this the book has been turned, just by its presentation, has been turned from what could be just a very small historic novel that, and you know, bless Wayne State for doing what they do.
Right.
But again, this is turned into a popular novel because, as I said on the back, it puts events back together with the eye of a crime scene investigator and first-class historian, which I knew you'd like.
I appreciate that.
But it's also true.
But I didn't want the book to come across as an academic work.
Right.
And I don't mean that, you know, I could write something academically. I'm an attorney. I write stuff academically all day long, but it's the type of stuff that makes your brain go dead when you read it. And this is a story where 73 people got killed. And I've had people come up to me after they've read the book and said, thank you for writing it the way you did, because they get the impression that I respected the story, and I was writing about it, and my wife might disagree with this, but I tried to inject a little bit of emotion into it, because I tend to write too mechanically as an attorney, and so I tried to put some emotion into it. And I think that Momentum Books is doing a very good job of marketing the book, not just saying, hey, everybody, here's a history book and it's dry, boring history. No, this is an interesting book that it's an interesting story. And the story really is important. We need to remember this.
Now, when you wrote this book, of course, we're talking about a period in 1913. We're talking about the truth behind Michigan's largest mass murder happened in 1913, Christmas Eve in Calumet. More than six dozen people are crushed to death after someone yells fire in this party that's put on for kids by the Western Federation of Miners. Man, I was re-summarizing the book, and I know I had a question in there. The question was, oh, yeah, the UP today, no more copper mines.
The copper mines are all closed. The only mines that are open for tourists. There's two or three of very nice tours you can take, the Delaware mine, the Quincy mine. But they stopped mining, and it was largely because, like, for instance, the Calumet and Hecla main shaft got a mile and a half down. They were over 9,000 feet into the earth when they basically, it got to the point where it took them so long to get down there and get back up with the stuff that wasn't becoming profitable anymore. So that's why the mines are pretty much all gone.
So there's copper down there. It's just not profitable.
Yeah, there actually is copper at the ground up there, but it got to the point where they found copper out west, and also the White Pine mine at the west end of the Upper Peninsula, where they could get it out cheaper because it was closer to the surface.
I think people often, too, here in the Detroit area where we're broadcasting from, don't realize how far away that is. When I went to Michigan State University, I had a roommate that was pretty close to the Wisconsin border, mm-hmm. and another roommate that was from New York. And am I correct that the guy from New York was closer, lived closer?
Probably or very close. I know I can make it up to Houghton Hancock area if I drive like a maniac, within the speed limit, of course, in about 8-9 hours.
Yeah.
And so that's a hike, and that's assuming that you get, you know, no bears wandering across the road in front of you and no snow.
Tell us a little, too, you were mentioning about the ethnic divide. You had the English language-speaking people, which I assume made up, well, in fact, you indicated this, the middle class and certainly the
yeah.
bosses of the copper mine. And beneath them that did the horrible work that actually set the basis for industrial America were the immigrants that spoke little or sometimes no English.
Right.
Finnish, Croatian, what else did you say, Italian?
Yeah, the Finns were actually the largest of the minority groups up there, but there were a lot of Italians and Croatians, and it was not uncommon, for instance, there'd be a quote-unquote Croatian boarding house, and there'd be a boarding house with 20 people living in it, all unrelated to each other, and they're all Croatians who are renting rooms.
How did they all wind up? How did the Finns all, you would tell, they were, I would, if I was Finnish, I'd go to Florida, you know, I mean.
But for some strange reason, people always want to emigrate someplace where they can have something familiar, and for some odd reason, the Finns like the snow, I think. But, yeah, you're right, there's a huge Finnish community up there, and I think it's because they knew there were jobs there. There was a point in time where there was 0% unemployment in the Keweenaw, because anybody who wanted to could walk up to a mine and say, I want a job, and they would give it to you. But the job would be pushing tram cars, which are basically railroad cars, filled with tons and tons of rock all day long.
So, yeah, these jobs were, I mean, maybe you could even talk a little about, you mentioned the pay, $2.50 a day, but,
yes.
and arduous labor.
Yeah.
I suspected that OSHA had not reached into those mines yet.
No. In fact, on average, about one miner a week was killed in the copper industry up there. So it was not uncommon when I'm doing my research on other things, I would come across a little blurb and would just say, you know, another Finn was killed today at the Calumet Hecla number 3. Wouldn't even say his name. And then, you know, a few days later you'd see, minor cave-in, four people had their legs crushed, but nobody killed. That kind of thing. And it was the same way you'd report a multi-car accident in Detroit. It's not that big of a deal, but it makes the news, but not that big.
Now, where did the people like the Finns and the Croatians, they came from, the Croats from Central Europe, or what? It's Southern,
yeah,
Southern
yeah.
Europe, and the Finns from Northern Europe,
yeah.
Where did they arrive at Ellis Island, or
yeah.
did they?
Yeah, no, they'd arrive at Ellis Island, and then what happens is a lot of times there would be recruiters in New York who'd say, hey, you want a job, you can go to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and get a job. And they'd be handing out flyers and leaflets. And then also a lot of people who'd come here earlier would send letters back home saying, hey, you know, they'll hire anybody. Send, you know, anybody who wants a job, get over here. And so they would show up looking for work.
Well, let's go back a little more in a couple minutes that we have remaining to I'm right. They call it often the Italian Hall Massacre.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, the 1913 massacre is what Woody Guthrie called it.
Oh, yeah, actually, I forgot about that. Now, where was someone just telling me that, or was it you that was telling me that that Arlo Guthrie sang it somewhere recently?
He might have. I know that Bob Dylan also occasionally did it in concert. And it was one of those songs where, you know, if you listen to it today, it wouldn't quite be a hit today.
Mm-hmm.
But it did a very good job. He wrote it in the 40s, and Woody was trying to, you know, describe the miners' plight. And he wrote a song called 1913 Massacre about this event.
So this had lasted, though, even, you know, we're talking about repressed history or forgotten history. This remained within the memories of people within the labor movement.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I've been contacted by people from, like, you know, the AFL-CIO and different union organizations from around the Midwest about this topic, because they are the ones who I think have kept it alive the most. I know that, like, there's a union headquarters in Lansing that has a brick from the Italian Hall on the wall as you walk into the lobby of their building. Because to them, the Italian Hall was always a tragic event in labor history.
Well, I think many do, and I'm sure you do, Steve Leto, know the number of people that perished in because of the simple desire to be to have better working conditions. Mm-hmm. I mean, even back to the 1880s through the 1930s, I think the figure is that 300 people were shot or otherwise killed by police and National Guard and militia and company goons during the 1930s.
Right, right.
And so the history of labor, a lot of the things we take for granted, although they're starting to erode,
right.
That we, at least our parents took for granted, were hard fought. Well, it is interesting that these unions maintain a memory of it. And,
yeah.
And one of the reasons, one of the many reasons that I wanted to have you on the show is the whole idea of the maintenance of memory is so important. And I suppose as a historian, that is also one of your motivators as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's, like I said, I was very concerned when I looked into this and found that nobody had ever written a full-length book about it. And it had been mentioned as a chapter in this book or that book, and I'd seen a couple places where it was mentioned. But the most detailed version of this story I could find was written in 1943. And nothing had been written since then that added anything to the story. And I thought, how is it possible that you know, 50, 60 years have gone by since then and nobody's updated the story? There must be more things that have popped up somewhere in archives and so on. And so when I started digging, I found stuff. And it's just that nobody had ever gotten around to doing it.
What was the biggest surprise, if there was a surprise? That
I was surprised at how slanted the newspapers were.
Mm-hmm.
The newspapers back then would outright lie to support the position of the mines. So that I read, for instance, the transcripts of a hearing, and the transcripts would have, you know, verbatim testimony that this person is testifying to, and the newspapers would report on what that person testified to, and the newspapers knew that no one at the time would have access to the transcripts except for a few people. And they would make up stuff. They'd say, this person said X, Y, Z.
Oh.
And the person never said that. And I point out in the notes to my book, I say, if you really want to get into this and have some fun, put the transcript next to the newspaper coverage and read them side by side, and it's like two different events.
Wow, that's absolutely incredible. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. This is an incredible story. Usually I read an endorsement or praise. I actually can tell where my ego's at. This is, I think it's the third time I've read this. But I say on the back of this wonderful book, wonderful in the sense that it maintains history. It gives us a look back on an event that undoubtedly shaped the lives of so many people. In that, let me see if I can do this quickly. Eventually, the miners did become unionized, though, right?
Oh, yeah. But it was about a decade or two before the unions got back up there. But what did actually come from this directly... The Department of Labor came up from Washington, D.C. and did an investigation into the event of the strike, and they were largely drawn because of the massacre. When they heard that 73 people died up here, it didn't matter why they died. They sent up a delegation, and it was one of the first things that the Department of Labor ever did as a department.
Well, my words in the back of the book are, Leto puts events back together with the eye of a crime investigator and first-class historian. It's a wonderful book, a wonderful account of a tragic event, Death's Door, the truth behind Michigan's largest mass murder. And it's published by Momentum. You can go to italianhall.blog.com, also to my site, peterwerby.com, where I'll have a link as well. Steve Leto, thanks for joining me in the studio.
Thank you.
Like a song you just heard?
Oh, yeah!
Listen up.
Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tunes for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected.
With 101
WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Junior's grave. WRIF and another fine edition of Night Call with Peter Werby. Time to get into the rock as we digest everything we just heard, which is a lot. Peter gives you plenty to chew on, as we will be doing with plenty of riff rock. And we'll take your request to 313-298-WRIF. Right now it's Bush, Come Down. It's Everything That Rocks, 101 WRIF.